This Tuesday for back-to-back badass blast of your favorite Riff Rock band.
Plus, the Riff gives you the hottest tickets to the coolest concerts and events happening around the Motor City.
Two for Tuesday.
Double the Riff Rock.
Double the Riff prizes.
Learn it, know it, live it.
Two for Tuesday on the Riff from
101 WRIS. If it rocks.
If it really rocks.
Now, begin transmission.
Here comes the music.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
Mike tried to get through a review of some art house flick, House of Sand and Fog. Yeah, there's a big budget thriller. Anyway, the Peanut Gallery had a pretty short attention span for this one.
Her dad had this house. She ended up getting the house, and she never opened her mail. And eventually the city took the house from her. She's trying to get the house
back.
And basically these foreigners moved in, and they built a porch higher up so that you could see the water in the distance, and they called it a water view to double their money.
Boring.
And that movie was playing in the theater. It was flooded with old Milwaukee, and strippers were drowning in it. I wouldn't step foot inside. Seriously, my wife would need a roll of duct tape and a wheelbarrow to get me to that one.
There's that vicious suicide in the end. I think it's like the Comcast On Demand or something.
If you super glued my genitalia to a cannonball and fired it through the front door of this theater, you couldn't get me to see a second of that.
I would rather wear Sally Jesse Raphael's panties like a ski mask than see this film.
I would rather pack my full of M80s and squat over a flaming hibachi than see this movie.
Wait a minute.
I would rather have a circle with my dad and grandpa this flaming turd of a movie.
Drew and Mike in the Morning. Broadcast program. On the Riff.
101-101.
W-R-I-F. Riff. Rocks.
Enter data.
No. It's the Riff's Rippin' Rock at 9 o'clock.
1 solid hour of your Riff Rock and Roll request.
All the excitement and fun you can bear.
With Meltdown, the big unit on the Riff.
Your opportunity to take control of the WRIF playlist
with the guy who lost control a long time ago.
Call in your Riff Rock and Roll requests to Meltdown at 313-298-WRIF or email them to meltdown@wrif.com.
The Rippin' Rock at 9 o'clock with Meltdown.
He's in big trouble.
101. WRIF.
At yahoo.com, or you can call in at 313-298-WRIF. That's going to be our number all night. We just want to make sure that we're streaming, because I know how frustrating it is if you have to depend on the internet. It's not like being here in the Motor City area. You just go to 101.1 FM and there you are. All right, well, here we are. We have open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Now I can barely contain myself, and why that is, I have so much to talk about the election, about the Bush policies, about Iraq, as usual. But I have been saying, I mean, almost for months, and particularly since Labor Day, that we had to talk about some of these other issues. And I don't know, they may sound not even as important as something like Iraq or some of the other issues that we talk about normally on Night Call. But they are. They all are, because a lot of them are about our lives. But I will talk later about the October surprise. Now, the October surprise is what the Republicans pull in the merry month of October to obliterate the Democratic opposition, to just leave the Democrats kind of going, So I'm going to tell you what I think it's going to be. You can tell me in advance if you think. 313-298-WRIF. Now, I'm barely containing myself, trying to, stay on the issues that I want to tonight. Now, it was funny. I was talking to a friend. I can't remember whether I brought this up last night, because this isn't an act. You know, I don't come here and be any different than I am with the people that I have normal discourse with. And sometimes people meet me and they say, gee, you're just like you are on the air. Well, hello. You know, I suppose you could put on an act, but not here. Not here. So I've been talking. Well, I was talking with this one guy that I know. I actually have known him for quite a few years, and he's an acquaintance mainly. And he had had a no war sign on. See, I'm getting into this, aren't I? I'm not going to get to the issue. I will. I promise. That he had a no war sign, and suddenly he took that up and put on a carry sign. Actually, he had a veterans for carry sign as well, because he's a veteran, ex-member of the military. And I said, "What happened to your no war sign?" And he almost got livid with me and said, "Hey, look, we've got to get rid of all of this talk about the war, because somehow or other, I mean, it's absolutely insane, because the Republicans," I'm not going to get to my subject, am I? All these Republicans are chicken hawks. They all scammed out of the draft. They all either got deferments, or like Bush lied through his teeth or got into the guard because of his rich daddy and all that stuff. So he said, what we're doing, and he said, we're not talking about education. We're not talking about women's rights. We're not talking about these right-wing wacko judges that that Bush has been putting into the federal court system and wants to put into the Supreme Court. We're not talking about the erosion of the environment," and on and on and on like that. And I thought, he is half right. Although Kerry now has opened up on Bush about Iraq, talking correctly, how this has cost us $200 billion, so we don't have any money for anything else. All right, but I don't want to do that. A couple of things I do want to say before. That would be a question I would ask to you. Should we cease talking about the war in Iraq? How can we? People are being killed. Our troops are killing lots of people, and a good number of them are getting killed themselves. We just, what should we say? Do you think people should be allowed to work in restaurants if they have visible tattoos? I mean, come on. I do, by the way. Think that people should be allowed to work in restaurants if they have visible tattoos. Saturday, beautiful day yesterday, I hosted the 7th annual Citizens Environment Alliance boat tour. It's the state of the Detroit River, and this is the 7th time I've done this. I'm already, isn't that true, folks, that CEA folks, that I'm now signed up for 2005 and 2006? Sold out again. There are a good number of you night call listeners there, even some of my friends. The first time I ever invited my friends, but by announcing it on my website, announcing it on this program, and telling my friends about it, the thing sold out pretty rapidly. I'm trying to convince the CEA people that we ought to do two boats next year. So about 250 of us sailed down the Detroit River looking at the spots that have been just destroyed by industrialism and the fact that the political system has allowed such environmental degradation, but also a few small victories as well. So I want to thank all of those folks. And if you hear about this next year, get on it quick if you want to go. Then, Friday night, that's right, the night before, my wife and I went to see the new John Sayles movie, Silver City. And it's presented in the trailers pretty much as a send-up of Bush, but it's not like that. There's a Bush-like character in there, but he's not central to it. It's a good little mystery, good little drama about political corruption and financial power and all that. And I highly recommend it. John Sayles, Silver City. You go to my website, and I can't remember. Oh, yeah, Dickie Pillager. That's the name of the family, the political family, Dickie Pillager. And there is a Dickie Pillager website. I think it's just DickiePillager.com if you don't want to bother to go to my site. My site's PeterWerbe.com, PeterWerbe, WERBE, PeterWerbe.com. All right, one more little titillation, if you will, and then we'll get into the suppressed subject. It's going to be about our work, our jobs, what fills great portions of our adult life, right? That is the battle of the signs. Now, I walk, and actually my wife's kind of had a little bit of a back problem lately, so mostly me, but she and I and our dog, we walk 3-4 miles every day, and we walk through this range of suburbs with differing social classes, so working class and middle class and even upper class. So we're walking through like Ferndale and Oak Park and Pleasant Ridge, sometimes over to Huntington Woods and Royal Oaks. There's a big range. Some of those cities have a range of classes, social classes, economic classes within them as well. And since this is a highly Democratic area, the Kerry signs, at least where we're walking, outnumber the Bush signs probably 6 or 7 to 1. Now, interestingly, probably the most affluent suburb of the ones I mentioned is Pleasant Ridge, at least west of Woodward Avenue, the main drag in Detroit, if you're one little geography for those of you listening out of town on the internet. And these huge houses, mansions, I don't know, they're mansions, but they're enormous houses. I mean, you could put, like, it would take three of my houses probably fit in one of these. And most of them have carry signs. So the more upscale people, almost 10 to 1, visible signs. I don't know how people are going to vote. I do. They're going to vote Democratic. In fact, all those suburbs will vote Democratic, as they always have. And there's maybe a spare Bush sign in this upper-class suburb. Then you go probably, it's a toss-up to which has more working-class areas, probably Ferndale or Oak Park. But you go in those districts, and there you see these Bush signs. Now, some of these houses that I'm talking about, houses aren't extraordinary. If you're listening, like in California, you wouldn't think much of the price, or you would probably think, what a buy in a lot of these houses. But these houses in the Detroit area that are about $750,000, probably out in a lot of California areas, would cost $2 million, $2.5 million, things like that. So, but these houses in Detroit, or in Oak Park, say, or in Ferndale, in the working class districts, that probably would go for $60,000 or $65,000. You see Bush signs on them. I can't figure this. I don't know. I mean, are they religious nuts, gun nuts, just sort of mean people, scared people, people that watch Foxhole News too much, and which then would lead you to be all the above things. I mean, it just doesn't make a bit of sense to me. Maybe you'd like to comment on that as well. For some reason or other, does this mean I was wearing this shirt on Friday? And what kind of hygiene do I have? I only wore it for about 2 hours, that's why. Yeah, I have my Silver City tickets here. If you're in the Detroit area, it's playing out at the Maple Art Theater and some other venues as well. It's not just an art film or anything like that. In Birmingham, which is an upscale area. Anyways, okay. So I'm going to tell you about what the October surprise will be, but let's get on to this. And it's work. Now, this stunned me, and I need your input on this. Even if you want to call up, I'm bad talk show host. Bad talk show host is supposed to introduce one subject and ask it as a question to get calls. I can't do that. I suppose I could have a program director said, look, I'm going to fire you if you do any more than introduce one topic and ask for comments. But I can't do it. My brain is, here's old Bob Dylan line, I've got a head full of ideas that are driving me insane. Yeah. And when I used to do this 6 days a week, when I used to do talk shows 6 days a week, it wasn't any better. In fact, I think it was worse in a way. Anyways, here, this is an Associated Press poll, AP poll. Most Americans fairly happy with work. Although a lot of it is contradicted by the article. Majority of Americans feel their job is satisfying and paid fairly. So that's the contention. Majority of Americans, according to this poll, feel that their job is satisfying and they are paid fairly. Many workers express concern about job stress, retirement benefits, and health care, according to this Associated Press poll. That kind of contradicts it. But the poll on the public's attitudes about work found that most workers in the United States were at least fairly satisfied with their jobs. A sizable number say they were unhappy with the stress level, health care, and retirement benefits at their job. 7 in 10 surveyed said they are paid fairly. So 70% of us say we're paid fairly for the work we're due. For the work we do, men were more likely than women to feel this way. Right. So the majority of people say that they like their job, it's satisfying, and 70% of us say, hey, we're getting paid fairly. Now, this was a while ago. Why is there no date on this? This was from USA Today. From the September 5th, so I've been holding this for like 2 weeks, always on the job employees pay with health. This, according to this article in the New York Times from September 5th, I think that was Labor Day. American workers are stressed out in an unforgiving economy. They are becoming more so every day, stressed out. 62% say their workload has increased over the last 6 months. 53% say work leaves them overtired and overwhelmed. Even at home, in the soccer bleachers, at the Labor Day picnic, workers are never really off the clock, bound to BlackBerries. Someone's got to call in and tell us what BlackBerries are. I think they're like little teeny computer things. Middle-class workers, you know, office workers have the cell phones and laptops, and add iffy job security, rising health care costs, ailing pension plans, and the fear that a financial setback could put mortgage payments out of reach. And the office has become, for many, an echo chamber of angst. Hey, man, wow. Angst, you know, just kind of dread, worry, this hollow feeling of nothingness. Yeah. It's enough to make workers sick, it says, and it does. Decades of research have linked stress to everything from heart attacks and stroke to diabetes and a weakened immune system. Workplace stress costs the nation more than $300 billion each year in health care, missed work, and the stress reduction industry has grown up to soothe workers and keep production high. Production, production, production. What's that? There is, let me see if I can remember his name, Eugene Ionesco, who wrote in what was called the Theater of the Absurd. There was a play called The Future Lies in Eggs. People were always chanting, production, production, production. Anyway, so even if you're going to comment on something else, tell me, are you one of the 70% surveyed that say they are paid fairly, or the malcontents that say they're not, right? This is hard for me to believe. And also, how many of you feel your job is satisfying? So you can either talk completely about that, or you can add that to what you're saying, or you can talk about something completely different, because we're all ADD on this bus. 313-298-WRIF. Call talkyes@yahoo.com. If you want to comment via email, you have a best chance to get it read on the air if it's short. I'll probably read it tomorrow, but if you're, you know, 800,000 word treatises, I can't accommodate on the air. What about me? Well, for once, I'm not a malcontent. I actually am very satisfied with the job here at WRIF. I love to do this. Said last week, I think, oh no, that was Labor Day. I was going to get the job, the day off, and I told our boss, Doug Podell, the program director and midday host here at WRIF, I don't want to come in. I want to talk. I want to talk to you. I want to hear you talk. And am I paid fairly? Yeah. I am. So for once, I may be in the majority. For once, I'm not the malcontent. But how about you? Do you think you're paid fairly? Do you think you're, I mean, how can this be when people all say that they are, the job is satisfying, when 62% say their workload has increased? Of course, you're not getting any more money. So essentially, you're getting a reduction in pay, a reduction in the quality of your life. And more than half say work leaves them overtired and overwhelmed. Gee, how can they say their job is satisfying? Well, we will find out. All right, I'm Peter Werby, and we're at 313-298-WRIF, and here's our first caller. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Doing good.
Doing good. This is Joe from Redford. I just wanted to comment on that, what you said about walking around and seeing a Bush sign on a house that was worth, you know, like $65,000. Being in a working man's neighborhood.
Right.
Well, myself, I am a Bush supporter. I'm a working man. I don't believe in everything that he says, but what he says, he does. Where Kerry, you know, he keeps flip-flopping left and right, right and left. You know, you tell him it's black, he'll tell you it's white.
You know, you're listening to too many Bush ads. I mean, Bush has changed his mind on almost everything.
Well, you know, when it comes down to it, you really can't believe either one of the two.
Vote for Nader, then.
You know what? If we were smart in this country, we all would vote for Nader.
Well, he's going to be on the ballot in...
Well, hopefully. I mean, they're still trying to push it through the...
No, it's there. House. It's there. You know, there was a candidate that was years ago, I mean, 100 years ago, that said it's better to vote for something you want and not get it than vote for something you don't want and get it.
Got it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is for sure. I mean, basically, when you boil it down, you can't believe any one of the politicians out there anymore. They're all wanting to pad their pockets. And, I mean, that's just it.
Well, some of them, well, these two guys, they don't need to pad their pockets. They come into it padded. But there's a lot of issues that are rarely talked about that are going to affect us very dramatically in terms of our standard of living. But tell me, what about how do you feel about your job and your pay?
You know, I'm a roofer, so you know I don't have the best job out there, but I do make a decent living on it. You know, I'm a single father raising two boys. We're not starving. Anything that we want, we get.
Really?
I've been brought up on the belief that if you can't afford to buy it, then don't charge it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's done us pretty fine.
Well, that's good. So you're satisfied with your job and satisfied with your pay?
Yeah. I mean, the pay could always be better. I don't know what job you're doing. Your pay could always be a little bit better. But for what I do, you know, I'm happy. I make $35,000 to $40,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
I get 3 months out of the year off. So, you know, I'm pretty happy.
That's like a teacher.
Basically, yeah.
Except they get June, July, and August. You get you get December, January, and whatever. Joe, thanks a lot for calling us.
All right, thanks, Peter. Have a good day.
Appreciate it. What did that make me think of? Pay. I can't remember. All right, it'll come back to me. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Doing good. Who's this?
This is Rob. I'm calling from Windsor.
Hi, Rob.
Yeah, you know, I'm very happy with the pay and the benefits I get, but I attribute that to be a unionized worker. You know, they negotiate great benefits, great wages, but other than that, I'm overworked.
Where do you work, Ford or Chrysler?
I work at Chrysler, yeah.
Yeah.
I work at the minivan plant. Yeah, we're overworked. The jobs are overloaded. A lot of people are getting hurt on the job. But
the CAW, the Canadian Auto Workers, is pretty often very militant union. How come it can't stand up adequately to Chrysler to stop? Essentially, what it used to be called in the old days was a speed-up. You did more work for the same pay.
Right. Well, you know, I attribute that to the trade agreements we have right now.
The NAFTA and this coming free trade area of the Americas.
Right. You know, it's very hard to compete with countries like Mexico and you know, some of the southern states down there that don't pay as much, and we're always it's always held against us.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Actually, you know, your union was one of the sponsors of this environmental riverboat tour that I took from Windsor. You know that boat? It's at the foot of Ouellette, and it just usually takes people out on dinner cruises.
Right, Aurora Borealis or something like that it's called.
Yeah. I think that may be it. Yeah. So thank you.
I just wanted to say something, too, about the October surprise.
Oh, what do you think it's going to be?
Well, I think it's going to do with either Iran or North Korea. And it's going to be something about an imminent threat of them having nuclear weapons. And all of a sudden, they're going to have the nuclear weapons now instead of being able to produce them in another 2 years. And I think that's going to be held over the American voters' head as well.
You got it. You got half of it, at least what I think. But, actually, I'll let that loose in a minute. Hey, Rob, thanks for making our show international.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate it. Thanks for joining us. So, there's three of us. Me, Joe, and Rob all say that we're satisfied with our job. This fits the AP poll where 7 in 10 surveyed that they were paid fairly, and a majority said that their job is satisfying. Now, the October surprise is, this is without going on a long explanation of what it was in 1980, almost a quarter of a century ago, where Reagan and his people schemed to cut the ground out from under Carter, who was running for re-election then, and pulled these shenanigans and these illegal negotiations with the, guess who, the Iranians. Remember that? Iran-Contra. The Republicans were up to their necks in selling arms to the terrible Ayatollah Khomeini. All right, so here is this October surprise. Still half. You got to remember, about a third of the country are just plain out fascists, right? So they're all going to vote for Bush, and then they're fascists, they're racist, they don't want equality of women and stuff like that. They're mean spirited. They don't like the people that make up the lot of the Democratic Party voters. As I said, some of them are religious or gun nuts, and all. So they're all sort of group. That's like the bottom third. So to get a majority, all they need is like 18%. So all of this hoopla is to get 18%, all these hundreds of millions of dollars that they're spending and they're raising from all the corporations and all that. I would say on the Democratic side, there's about a hardcore of about 20%. So they got to get a little more. The race, depending on whose polls you look at, Bush tends to be in the lead now. Pardon me. And the others is kind of a little too close to call. But I would tend to give it, that is the poll numbers right now, to Bush, which is just astounding to me, absolutely astounding. We'll talk about that a little more. Now, here's what's happening. The Bushies, Bushco, have made their, what do they call it? Their made men, you know, that mafia thing, on terror. They're the terrifiers in chief. That they've done everything they can to play the card that always worked for them, the terror card. Now, people in other countries have terrorists, and it's not front and center with every aspect of life. Of course, no one ever took as big a hit, that is from European or North American countries, as we did on September 11th. So the concern, the fear, and what have you. But Bushko, Cheney, and those folks have ramped this up, and they've played the terror card whenever it's convenient for them. You know, all these insane orange alerts or whatever the hell they are. I think they've completely now retired those, fortunately. But here's the CBSNews.com. This is what we're going to face in a week or so. Convinced that Al-Qaeda is still determined to disrupt the U.S. fall elections by an attack on the homeland. When did that word homeland come in? It always has this kind of Germanic sound to it, doesn't it? Anyways, FBI officials are preparing a massive counteroffensive of interrogation, surveillance, and possible detentions they hope will disrupt the terrorist plans. Now, here we go. So what we're going to do, we're going to, the maw, the mouth, the yawning maw of terror is going to open widely, and we're all going to be thrust into it, and the compliant corporate media is going to just turn its attention away from everything else that has any impact on our lives, like jobs, like education, like the environment, the rights of women and people, and associated issues like that. So it's all going to be about terror, and if it's all about terror, Bush wins. In fact, I'm discouraged to the point. You could call me up and say, don't be so discouraged, Pete, at 313-298-WRIF. But this is very discouraging, because on my website, I don't have it open now, but it says something like, how dumb do they think the American people are? And they think we're real dumb, and sometimes they're right. In terms of their capacity, Bushko's capacity to fool us. Now, beginning the first week of October through the elections, FBI field offices and Homeland Security agencies will be advised of extraordinary measures. Let's see. Specifically, the plan calls for aggressive, even obvious surveillance techniques to be used on a short list of people suspected of being terrorist sympathizers but who have not committed a crime. Other persons of interest, including their family members, may also be brought in for questioning. So essentially, this is going to be aimed at the Arabic community, the Muslim community, South Asian community. So you say, well, aren't people going to protest against this? Isn't this going to be just this witch hunt that's motivated purely and solely by politics? Because if there are real threats, they can do this without making a big public deal about it. Like the cops, when they're investigating crime, they don't go to the press and say, we're investigating some crimes and put this on the front page. They go about their business. And that's what police activity is about. We're not involved in a war. That involves frontal positional warfare with armies on the other side. We're looking at criminal right-wing religious nuts that want to hurt us, because of their perception of how we function in the world towards the Middle East particularly. This calls for police work, and they should do it diligently. How diligently are they doing it? We'll talk about that in a little while. Now, but they're counting on a minor backlash. They're counting on the Arab-American Anti-Defamation League. I think that's the name. They're counting on the American Civil Liberties Union, and people will say, see, that's who is supporting the terrorists. So this is going to work, I think. The other thing, and was it Rob? Yeah, Rob said that a possible attack on Iran. Here in Newsweek, the U.S. weighs the price of a preemptive strike. Unprepared as anyone is for a showdown with Iran, the threat seems to keep growing. Many defense experts in Israel, the United States, and elsewhere believe that Tehran has been taking advantage of loopholes in the nuclear non-proliferation treaty and is now within a year of mastering key weapons production technology. They can't prove it, of course, but what the hell? That never stopped George W. Bush. All you got to do is make the assertion, right? Well, they've got 500 tons of mustard gas and 100 tons of something else that's going to creep up in your home in Tulsa and strangle you. But then, of course, it turns out to all be a load of BS. Nevertheless, last week, U.S. and Israeli officials were talking of possible military action, even though some believe it's already too late to keep Iran from going nuclear, if it chooses. After the Iraq debacle, that means that Bush's war based on lies. After the Iraq debacle, calls for regime change without substantial evidence of weapons of mass destruction are not likely to gain a lot of traction. So there is the look for that. And also they may, just for good measure, pull Osama bin Laden out of a box if they have him. If they don't, they're not going to catch him because they've taken the resources that should have been used to capture this man responsible, we believe, for September 11th, and instead put it where there was no threat against Iraq. All right, let's take one more call, and then we'll go to spots. Hi, WRIF in here. Woo. Hello. I don't think we want to go to that one. Thank you. Dan Letarski, who is the phone screener. Say hello to him when you call 313-298-WRIF. It's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Doing well.
You asked, or you were talking about how 70% of the people can be happy with their jobs.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that when you turn the TV on with 24-hour news, you hear constantly how everybody's losing their jobs and the economy's in the toilet. Well, if you hear that all the time and you have a job, well, you're going to be pretty damn happy with that job because you hear other people don't have one. And when everybody's got something, well, then you start complaining about, hey, I'd like mine to be a little better.
Mm-hmm.
But when you hear everybody else is losing theirs, if you've got one, well, heck, you're pretty happy with what you have just in comparison.
Well, also, polls are kind of often flaky things. I mean, these election polls generally tend to be pretty accurate. But there's a lot when pollsters ask people personal stuff, they're often very unreliable.
Yeah, oh, possibly, but you see what I'm saying.
Oh, I do.
Even in a worst-case scenario, and I don't know whether this is happening or not. I mean, our office hasn't seen any of it, but let's say you work for the auto industry or for the tech industry and you see 20 people in your office lose their job. Well, even though you're doing a little more work,
yeah,
you're still getting a check every week. So that tends to make you fairly happy.
I think that's
a good
point.
Now, when everybody's got a job and you're fat and happy, then you start complaining about things. But it's almost at work you hate to complain for fear you're next. And when you're not at work, you are pretty happy because you're still feeding your family. So I think that poll is probably pretty accurate.
I think that's an excellent point. Thank you so much.
Have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye now. But on the other hand, there's a famous book, it could be, I don't know, over 20 years old, by one of the best interviewers in the business, now probably way in his 80s, Studs Terkel. Isn't his name spelled, is it T-E? No, it's T-U-R-K-E-L, Studs Terkel. Or if you don't get anything, if you're looking it up and it's not a U, try T-E. But Studs Terkel interviews everybody. And he's a wonderful interviewer, and he can really get inside of people. And he wrote a famous book, his question and answers. It was called Working. And he asked people about their attitudes about working. And at the outset, he said, do you like your job? And everybody said, yeah, I like my job. You happy there? Yeah. Getting paid good? Yeah. And then he asked, and he asked, and he asked. And by the end of these interviews, they're saying, I hate my boss. I can't believe my whole life is drifting away while I'm doing this meaningless crap. I wish I was this or that and what have you. So people have the tendency to give, at the outset, strangers who happen to be taking polls, the answers that they think puts them in the best light or they think that the pollsters want to hear. Most famous incorrect poll answers are when you ask people about how religious are you, about church attendance. And so the United States is probably the industrial country with the most churchgoers in the world. You go to other countries in Europe, you got probably anybody under 50 even going, and it's probably about 15% church attendance. Here you get like 70% of people, and you say, you go to church or whatever your religious establishment. Oh, yeah. How many do you go regularly? Oh, yeah. And so they took people at their word. I mean, who would lie about going to church? Figured the contradiction there. Well, then someone started figuring out, if everybody in particular, they could figure this out easier in smaller towns. If everybody in smaller towns went to church as frequently as they claimed in these polls, you couldn't fit them all into the churches. You couldn't come anywhere near fitting them into the churches. So they were exaggerating. They didn't go every single Sunday and to the Bible school and whatever. People go to something on Wednesdays or something like that. And what's the other thing? Oh, yeah, sex. Do you have sex? How frequently do you have sex? Oh, I don't know. 5-6 times a week. Yeah. These are people like in their 40s. And yeah, some of you may. I ain't talking. And no need. You can if you want because you're more anonymous than I am. So here's the way it looks. When these people aren't at their jobs that they love and are paid fairly, they're either having sex or going to church, right? I mean, that's the only way to look at it. So I wouldn't put too much stock in it. All right, let's take a break, and we'll be right back to get your calls.
This is the Riff's award-winning Night Call with Peter Werby. You can call in at 313-298-WRIF. Peter will return with more of your calls in just a moment.
Hi, I'm David Hall with a different kind of news from Rock Financial. If you or anyone you know is looking for an exciting career with unlimited potential for earning and advancement, you need to listen. Rock Financial, Michigan's number one mortgage company, is growing every day. And the reason's simple. We make our team members happy, so they make our clients happy. Now we're looking for great people for our Livonia, Auburn Hills, Farmington Hills, and our new Troy office. People dedicated to giving personal service to each and every client. And if that describes you, go to rockfinancialcareers.com or you can call 800-411-JOBS. We want your best, so we give you our best. Training, benefits, and technology. And we make work fun. So much fun, Rock Financial was chosen the best place to work in all of Metro Detroit. And Fortune Magazine says we're the 13th best place to work in the entire country. You'll love coming into work every day. If you can't say that now, go to rockfinancialcareers.com. Or call 800-411-JOBS. Rock Financial, the Quicken Loans company, and an equal opportunity employer. Go to rockfinancialcareers.com.
Men, how do you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of stamina you want and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make the pleasure go on and on with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral free for 30 days. 1-800-270-9580. 1-800-270-9580. You pay only shipping and handling. Call now, have your credit card handy, and try Maxtral free for 30 days. 1-800-270-9580. 1-800-270-9580.
Hi, ever see those people driving down the interstate with their turn signal on? Mile after mile after mile. Think they've forgotten about it? No, it's a little memory device they're using to remind themselves of the healthy snack.
Cars nuts, cars nuts, cars nuts.
Cars nuts, low in carbs, high in protein, no cholesterol. We only use premium nuts, meticulously slow roasted and seasoned to perfection. Kind of makes you hungry, doesn't it? Go ahead, put your turn signal on. Oh, sure, you'll confuse a few drivers. Some will even gesture at you.
Hey, you moron!
But stay the course. Make the smart choice. Just head to the nearest service station or convenience store because nearly every one of them stocks Cars Nuts. And even though the next exit is 10 miles ahead, keep your turn signal on and remember,
Cars Nuts, Cars Nuts, Cars Nuts.
Make the right turn. Cars Nuts. That's Cars with a K. Okay? Since 1939.
Kids, eat your vegetables.
Why?
Because they have vitamins that are good for you. Kids, go outside and play.
Why?
Because fresh air is good for you. Parents are always telling kids why something's good for them. Kids, time for bed.
Why?
Because sleeping is good for you. So don't be surprised when they start telling you.
Mom, don't smoke anymore.
Why?
Because it's not good for us.
Protect your children from secondhand smoke. If you or someone you know smokes, ask them to take it outside. Secondhand smoke can cause bronchitis, pneumonia, ear infections, and asthma in children. So if you're a smoker, don't smoke around people you love. Better yet, quit. Just call 1-800-537-5666 for more information. That's 1-800-537-5666. A message from the Michigan Department of Community Health and the Michigan Association of Broadcasters.
This is Nightcall. This is Nightcall, the Riff's phone-in talk show. Now, here's Peter Werby.
As you might expect, the show has generated some controversy.
Consider that in the past 6 months, we have freed more minds than in 6 years.
Back at Green Day on Night Call. 313-298-WRIF. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. Posing the question, although we're talking about the things we often talk about. According to this poll, most Americans are fairly happy with work. 7 in 10 surveyed said they are paid fairly, and also that the majority are happy, satisfied. I don't know how deep this goes, but... always on the job, employees pay with health, says another article. And 62% of workers say their workload has increased over the last 6 months. That wouldn't make me very happy. What else? Also, yes, the coming Republican October surprise will be, and remind me of this. I mean, some of you conservative listeners like to remind me when the things that I say are wrong. And I don't mind that in the least. These right-wing shows who make these incredible errors of fact. You can have an opinion. You can say, I think the war in Iraq is good. That's an opinion. I mean, I think you're an idiot if you say that. But and these right-wing talk show hosts are idiots. But it's their opinion, and they think I'm an idiot. So that's all right. But they are incorrect frequently, and there's never any admission. So here's what I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to say the October surprise where the Bushko will hope to just dump Kerry right in the basket will be twofold or even threefold. I mean, they may capture Osama bin Laden, but it's going to be this anti-terror, anti-terror plan, but it's got to be more than that. Suddenly the whole country is going to be roiled, R-O-I-L-E-D, around this plot by al-Qaeda to disrupt the election. So there's going to be the FBI and Homeland Security are going to be taking people in, questioning people. The uproar, the protest is going to work in Bush's favor because people are going to say, the ACLU doesn't want us protected from these terrorists. Right. Also, a very good possibility of a strike on the Iranian nuclear reactor. And Russia's helping Tehran build this plant in a town called, interestingly, Bushehr, B-U-S-H-E-H-R. That's interesting. And maybe they'll pull Osama bin Laden, or as we call him here, Osama bin Forgotten, not even mentioned, at the Republican Con. You know, that took took place a couple of years ago. The economy's going great guns, according to Bush, but there's no reason to believe anything he says. According to Reuters, U.S. retail sales dipped in August, and the most comprehensive gauge of the U.S. international trade gap widened to a record in the second quarter, according to government reports. So things are not getting better at all. They just want to squeak through. They want to squeak through this... this election, and then all hell, you know, everything can go to hell. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter, how are you doing tonight?
Doing good.
Hey, I have a rather disturbing Bush story I want to share with you and your listeners. I was in West Virginia last week and picked up a local newspaper in a town we were staying at. And in the paper was a story of a local couple went to hear Bush speak sometime last summer. He was there. And they were sitting in the audience, and once he starts speaking, they took off their shirts and they had anti-Bush T-shirts on underneath.
Well, that was their ass, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's nothing profane. It's just Bush with a circle through it, and that's all was on their shirts. They did not interrupt the meeting or anything of that sort. But they said they sat there for about a minute after they revealed the shirts. Secret Service took them out of the talk, and they subsequently arrested them.
Well, that's been happening all around the country.
Well, I just find that amazing that Bush and... that, you know, Bushko, as you call them, can just trample over people's freedom of speech rights like that, and the general public doesn't even seem to care or even notice it.
sure. Well, I mean, it's out there, but it doesn't seem to bring any great waves of indignation. Yeah, all along that this has been the mode is that no dissent is allowed. I said a couple of weeks ago I'd heard an old recording of when Harry S. Truman was giving an election speech, must have been 1948, and when he would say something, you would hear clapping, and then you would hear people booing.
Right.
So Republicans would come to Harry S. Truman's talk, and they didn't like what he said. So they would go, boo! I don't know, do people boo anymore? I think that's pretty old-fashioned. I don't know what people do now. Well, you can't do it.
Well, you'll get arrested.
Yeah, you'll get arrested.
Well, I just find that amazing that the public just puts up with this.
It's
turned into a dictator.
Well, George Bush has said on four separate occasions that his favorite form of a government is a dictatorship, although he always laughs like he's kidding, of course. Well, are you going to keep listening to the show?
I've been a long time listening.
No, I mean in the next 2 minutes.
Oh, yes.
All right, well, I hang up and I'll give you another Bush Co. horror story, okay?
Okay, well, I got one more thing.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Now I hang up and let you comment on this. What are your thoughts on Howard Stern and the whole thing he's going through with FCC and Colin Powell's son?
Oh, well, I mean, he was fine until he started criticizing Bush. When he was a big Bush supporter and an Iraq war supporter, he just kind of got, was ignored. Then all of a sudden, you know, he's too obscene for radio.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, what about any thoughts? We were asking people whether they're happy with their job and think they're fairly paid.
I think I'm fairly paid. I think it's ridiculous what the government defines poverty at, what... $16,000 or something.
$18,000 for a family of four, I think.
Yeah, $18,000 for a family of four, which I think is a joke. I think I could be paid more for my job, but I'm lucky it is a government job, so I do get comp time.
Yeah, great.
So I do get a lot of days off.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate your call. Well, here's another case. Laura Bush was giving a campaign speech about how the debt that we owe our American soldiers, particularly the ones that have lost their lives, how her husband is in the forefront of the war against terror, and if we want to be safe, we've got to elect her husband. Well, the mother of a soldier killed in Iraq was arrested after she interrupted a campaign speech by Laura Bush. This is in Hamilton, New Jersey, and Sue Niederer was wearing a T-shirt with the message, President Bush, you killed my son. And she lives in Hopewell, New Jersey. She screamed questions at the first lady as the audience tried to drown her out by chanting, four more years. She pressed on, refused to leave, and eventually police removed her. Let's see. Outside, Niederer said she wanted to ask Laura Bush why the senators, the legislators, the congressmen, why aren't their children serving? She went on to blame the president for the death of her 24-year-old son, Army First Lieutenant Seth DeVorn. He was killed by a roadside bomb. As the Hamilton police and Secret Service agents surrounded her and reporters pressed her with questions, she held her ground, claiming, I had my ticket to attend the speech by Laura Bush. Then they handcuffed her. Cops handcuffed her, and she's charged with defiant trespass. What the hell is that? Turns out she is one of the many members of an organization called Military Families Speak Out. There's 1,600 military families, and let's see here. You can actually, let me see, where I think it's, MF. Like in families, SO, Military Families Speak Out, MFSO.org. Now, Nancy Lesson and Charlie Richardson are their co-founders of Military Families Speak Out. I've interviewed Nancy Lesson before. It is our loved ones, they say, who are or have been or will be on the battlefront. It is our loved ones who are risking injury and death. It is our loved ones who are returning scarred from their experiences. It is our loved ones who will have to live with the injuries and deaths among innocent Iraqi civilians. The two primary justifications used by the Bush administration to take this nation into war, weapons of mass destruction, and a link between Al-Qaeda and Saddam have proven to be false. Each day, week, and month that this reckless military misadventure continues, the death toll goes higher. So you think, oh, they're partisans. They dislike George W. Bush. Well, we'll see what the Republicans are saying in just a little bit. Hey, welcome to Jeff from Detroit Rock City. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Doing good. Jeff sponsors, all of a sudden I just blanked. What are we calling him?
Liberal
Liberal-palooza.
Liberal-palooza, that's right. I spoke at the last one. And you got another one coming up on October, don't have it in front of me.
October 2nd.
Saturday, October 2nd, right?
October 2nd and November 6th will be the last one. And we're in need of a fifth band once again. We've got a last-minute pullout for October 2nd. So if there's anyone that hates Bush and wants to come out and rock, give us a call at 586-754-7827.
Okay. That's
but
good.
I found another good reason to get out and vote this year, Peter.
What's that?
Not only do we get the opportunity to vote out Mr. Bush, but Michigan gets the opportunity to legalize medical marijuana.
That's on the Michigan ballot?
It's on the Michigan ballot under Proposal C.
That's amazing.
I got information about this from the Mount Clemens chapter of Normal. And apparently no one else seems to know anything about this. I haven't heard anything else from anywhere else.
Well, I sure haven't either.
We don't want anybody to know it.
Well, you would think that the pro-medical marijuana people would. We got to do a little fact-checking on this, Jeff. I won't say you're wrong, but I'm a little dubious.
Just passed it in Detroit.
It did pass in Detroit, fortunately. One of the things that's on the ballot, and someone, oh, I'm terrible, I have to remind me which proposal it is an attempt of these right-wing busybodies to make it unconstitutional for the state to allow gay marriages. So they're going to disgrace our state by putting it in our founding document that people that love one another have to be determined by their gender. I mean, what an absolute disgrace they're going to make of us. Yeah.
That's
all right. Terrible. Well, remind us of your website again. People can go to Bands Against Bush, which is a national site, by the way.
Or the website for Detroit is anyonebutbush2004.us.
All right. Well, call us next week and remind us again so we'll get some more people out there.
Sure thing.
All right, Jeff, thanks.
Thank you later, Peter.
Thanks for joining us. Detroit Rock City's the place in Warren. And also next Sunday, I may try to do this. Got to put my bike together. This is in bicycle. Right? This is why I'm a girly man, right? I have a bicycle, not a motorcycle. But there's going to be Bikes Against Bush as well. It's going to be on Belle Isle. You have to go to my website. Sorry, I don't have all this information in front of me. PeterWerby.com, W-E-R-B-E, PeterWerby.com. If you're listening far away and you're thinking, what the hell? The guy's talking about Detroit. What's Belle Isle? I don't even know what that is. Use this kind of stuff either as general information to know what people are doing or as good ideas for what you can do wherever you are listening. Elections coming up, and the vote, the process is so suspect that there's international election monitors arriving in the United States. And the group, where is this? Oh, yeah, Global Exchange. Go to globalexchange.org. They're bringing in people to monitor these very, very suspicious electronic voting systems that people increasingly think are unreliable at best and subject to manipulation, always in the Republicans' favor, of course, at worst. And one of the founders of GlobalExchange.com, Madea Benjamin is going to be here speaking at the Wayne State University Law School on Thursday at noon. I think I'm going to go down and check her out. Some of you people that have listened for a long time know I've interviewed Madea any number of times, but this is Jason Mark, who works with Fair Election. It's a project of Global Exchange. He said electoral experts from 14 countries will arrive in the United States this week to begin an unprecedented international monitoring of U.S. elections. That's how bad our reputation is. Where's democracy? The 20-person team consists of distinguished pro-democracy advocates who have spent much of their lives creating and improving electoral systems in their home countries. The electoral observers will spend 2 weeks in the U.S. investigating controversies that appear to be undermining public faith in the U.S. political process. Please do it, so we won't have any of this Florida crap or fact that people, particularly minorities, have been excluded from voting. Greg Pallast says that there could be as many in the last election, 1 million African-American votes that were not counted. So by all, if you had a fair election, Bush would not be sitting in the White House today. All right, let me see. What's this? Ryan from Redford says, I believe your study of job happiness comes from a mostly mature crowd. I would imagine the youth of America sing a different song. I know myself at 22 have had a hard time juggling a job in college coming from a family that can't afford to give me much of an assist. And, of course, now college is getting so incredibly expensive because of cost and, you know, Bushko sending $200 billion of our money to his pals to destroy and rebuild Iraq. Actually, they're not even spending this money to rebuild. All they're doing is destroying the country. Needless to say, I haven't been blessed with the perfect situation to zip through college and move on to a career, leaving me desperate to get out and live my own life with my own house and the whole nine yards. I do what I have to and regret every Monday knowing I am in for another unsatisfying week. So we're talking about this poll that says the majority of people are satisfied with their job. Ryan is our first malcontent from Canton, so we'll see. So, but we love malcontent, so you can call us.
Your opinion matters. Call 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call and more of your calls coming up.
All right, you guys have been great. I want you to meet some people over here on drums. Scott Whitney. The guy on my left, holding down the harp, Larry Geis. Yeah. To the right, we got Tim Cawley on bassoon. My man in back with all the angles, Jory Edmonds on triangle.
Rock without guitars. That's like beer without taste. So this summer, join Miller and celebrate 50 years of great rock by choosing the beer with more taste than Bud Light. Great tasting, less filling, Miller Lite. Miller, good call.
In a nationwide taste test, even Bud Light drinkers said Miller Lite had more taste. Testing conducted by the Institute of Perception, Richmond, Virginia. Results reflect which beer has more taste, not preference or carb count.
Taste for yourself. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Live responsibly.
All the 2004s must go at Smith Camp Chrysler Jeep, Metro Detroit's original. Get to Smith Camp this week for sign and drive leases with zero down, and we'll even make your first monthly payment. And everyone may qualify for Daimler Chrysler employee discounts. Lease a 2004 Jeep Grand Cherokee for only $256 a month. We have over 100 available at this price. Or get a 2004 Jeep Liberty for only $199 a month. We have over 70 in stock at this price. Or lease a 2005 Chrysler Town & Country for only $204 a month. Get the hot Sebring sedan for only $169 a month. Incredible deals on the 2004 Chrysler PT Cruiser. Only $133 a month. Chrysler Pacificus for only $163 a month. All credit requirements have been relaxed for this clearance event. You must be a Daimler Chrysler employee, eligible relative, friend, or acquaintance with zero due at signing for a 36-month lease. Check out the all-new Chrysler 300 and drive it home today. For complete lease details, call toll-free 866-36-10000. That's 866-36-10000. See our ad in today's local newspapers or visit snethcamp.com. Snethcamp, Metro Detroit's original, on Telegraph, just south of I-96.
Snethcamp. If you need to sell your home, commercial property, or vacant land fast because of a divorce, a threat of foreclosure, or a family estate, Arrow Realty can help. Even if you are just plain broke or struggling for any reason, Arrow Realty has the fast cash solution for you. Arrow Realty buys homes, commercial property, and vacant land for cash in any situation, in any condition. Take the stress and worry out of selling your property. Forget about trying to find a buyer. Forget about showings, open houses, and paying high broker commissions. When you need the quick sale of your property, no matter what situation you are facing, you can count on Arrow Realty to get you the cash you need fast. Call Arrow Realty at 734-941-4595 today to discuss the possible sale of your property. Let the experts at Arrow Realty help you today. Arrow Realty, they have the solution to get you cash fast for your property. Call Arrow Realty at 734-941-4595 and put the experts to work for you today. That's 734-941-4595. 734-941-4595.
The initial impression that the world receives from your face is important, and it shouldn't be an impression of your age. Have you been worrying about the effects of aging, but reluctant to do something about it because of the involved procedures and long recovery time? Then call Dr. Roche and ask about an S-lift. This popular technique achieves a more natural look compared to traditional facelift procedures and with shorter recovery time. An S-lift is a way to erase years and return your face to a natural, beautiful look. This simple procedure utilizes a minimal incision and will rebuff the aging process by removing excess skin, and tightening the lower face and neck muscles, giving you a more youthful appearance. The S-Lift can also be used in combination with other procedures to help bring back a more confident you. Dr. Roche has over 20 years of experience and was voted best plastic surgeon in Detroit by Our Magazine. Call Dr. Roche in Bluefield Hills today at 877-338-1110 for a consultation or visit drroche.com. That's DRROCHE.com.
Put your best face and body forward. Dr. Gregory Roche.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Now, more of your comments, questions, and opinions with your host, Peter Werby.
Hey, what kind of talk is that? It's un-American. Did George W. Bush quit even after losing the popular vote? No. Did he quit after losing millions of dollars of his father's friends' money in failed oil companies? No. Did he quit after knocking that girl up? No. Did he quit after he got that DUI? No. Did he quit after getting arrested for drunken disorderly conduct at a football game? No.
All right, welcome back. I was looking for something. I don't think I have this with me. It was talking about Bush and his. I mean, he was having real behavior problems. Oh yeah, here it is. Bush, when he was remember when he left the guard essentially when he was AWOL in 1972. It says, pardon me. This is from the Nation, thenation.com. magazine, one of the oldest publishing weekly magazine in America. The family that rented Bush a house in Montgomery, Alabama, during that period, told me that Bush did extensive inexplicable damage to their property, including smashing a chandelier, and that they unsuccessfully billed him twice for the damage, which amounted to approximately $900, a considerable sum in 1972. Two unconnected close friends and acquaintances of a well-known Montgomery socialite, now deceased, told me that the socialite in question told them that he and Bush had been partying that evening at the Montgomery Country Club, combining drinking with the use of illicit drugs, and that Bush, complaining about the brightness, had climbed on a table and smashed the chandelier when the duo stopped at his home briefly so Bush could change his clothes before they headed out. It is notable that in 1972, the military was in the process of introducing widespread drug testing as part of the annual physical exams that pilots would undergo. And that's what was happening. I mean, Bush did not take his physical. He probably couldn't pass it. And his failure to complete a physical exam became the official reason for his subsequent suspension from flying status. In the meantime, the Navy's chief investigator concluded that procedures were followed improperly in the approval of Senator John Kerry's Silver Star, Bronze Star, and Purple Heart medals, according to an internal Navy memo. So that's all a lot of crap, actually. And let me say that there was one more thing. Oh, yeah. That this was in a column in the New York Times, Nicholas Kristof. He says that, what do those who served with Kerry say? Some who served on other boats have called Kerry a self-promoter, but every enlisted man who was with Kerry on various boats when he won Purple Hearts, Silver, and Bronze Stars say he deserved them. All praise his courage and back his candidacy. Everybody on his boat. I was in Delbert Sandusky, in a typical comment, says, I was there for two of the Purple Hearts and the Bronze and Silver Stars, and he earned every one of them. He saved our lives. So is there any exaggeration or self-promotion? Hey, I don't know. It could be. But he was there. The Navy says he deserved the medals. Bush, this snotty rich kid, I mean, who got into the guard to protect his butt from having to go to Vietnam, has the respect of many military people. Absolutely unbelievable. Maybe this is why Mike in Royal Oak wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He said, Peter, I'm tearing my hair out. When a Bush voter calls, like the roofer who called tonight, please don't just let them off the hook. I kind of do, because as this show, you know, like 95% of us think that Bush was unfairly seated. He cheated his way, just like he cheated his way through life, cheated his way into the presidency, has lied about everything, and is sending this country down the road to hell. Hey, by the way, if Kerry wins, what I was saying before, when Kerry wins, I'm changing to if Kerry wins, it's not going to be heaven. You know? It's just not going to be more hell. That's the difference. He says, I think you need to challenge these Republicans to explain why they're voting for Bush. You might be able to change their mind with just a few facts. For example, when a Bush voter babbles something about flip-flopping, please ask them to elaborate. Then you can explain the details behind their stupid soundbite crap. Mike, you got to tell us what you really think. If anyone took the time to read the transcripts of what Kerry actually said in the Senate, oh, never mind, it's hopeless. Well, it is hopeless mostly with those guys. I do agree, Mike. Kerry has, he was being a politician on some of the ways he has responded, much to his detriment. On the other hand, Bush has flip-flopped a million times, and as Lowell from Shanghai reminds us, that it's not a matter of flip-flopping that's the problem with Kerry, it's a matter of flops. You know, that old-fashioned phrase of failures on everything. From this war? Now, who says that this war was bad? Well, a comprehensive search for weapons of mass destruction has concluded. This is an Iraq survey group. This is Bush set this in motion. The final report circulating in Washington found no evidence of illegal stockpiles that the U.S. and Britain presented as a justification for going to war, nor did it find any evidence of efforts to reconstitute Iraq's nuclear weapons program. So it's all a lie. At best, it was a mistake. You want to say it's a mistake? Well, how bad a mistake do you have to make before you get your butt kicked out of somewhere? Thousands and thousands and thousands of people have died. You got to remember, here's why the war began on March 13th, 2003. It was becoming very clear through the weapons inspectors, through the United Nations inspection program that Saddam Hussein was allowing, that there were no weapons of mass destruction. And if they would have waited another 30 days as France wanted, France wasn't saying surrender to Iraq. They were saying, we want to know whether they have any weapons of mass destruction. The 1,028 Americans, if they would have listened to France, if they would have listened to the tens of millions of people around the world, the millions of Americans, then our 1,028 Americans would still be alive. 7,000 Americans would not have the wounds and the scars for the rest of their lives that they have. Thousands, we don't even know what it is, 20,000 Iraqis wouldn't be dead, and tens of thousands more wounded. And it's a lot worse than that. Now, the National Intelligence Council presented Bush this summer. Now, this is just typical of the kind of lying that they do as a matter of course to the American people. And you dodos just don't, whatever. What could this guy do to turn you away from the failures, the catastrophic failures that have resulted from his administration? His own National Intelligence Council presented Bush this summer with three pessimistic scenarios regarding the security situation in Iraq, including the possibility of civil war. They kept this buried. They absolutely kept this buried. So it was highly classified. They looked at the political, economic, and security situation, and they determined that a tenuous stability was possible. That's the best we're going to get out of it, and it ain't just going to happen. It's going to be hundreds, maybe thousands more Americans are going to die. Thousands and thousands of more Iraqi civilians are going to die. The document lays out a second scenario in which increased extremism and fragmentation in Iraqi society impede efforts to build a central government. In a third, worst-case scenario, the Intelligence Council contemplated, quote, trend lines that could point to a civil war. It would be fair to call the document pessimistic, the official added. Bush says everything's just going splendidly. So who are all these people criticizing Bush? Well, leading members of the Republican Party today criticized mistakes and what they called incompetence. They appeared on talk shows. Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska said, the fact is we're in deep trouble in Iraq, and I think we're going to have to look at some recalibration of policy. John McCain, Arizona Republican, said, we have made serious mistakes. McCain said Bush has not perhaps not as straight as maybe we'd like to see. That's a nice way of saying he's lying about important issues. He's not straight. I mean, how would you like it if people in your family, your mother or father, your wife or your brother, wasn't being as straight as you'd like to see? In other words, was hiding things, wasn't telling you the complete picture, was giving you a rosy outlook when the opposite was true, and every expert has said that. In your own family, well, you wouldn't think very highly of that person. If they did it all the time, you might even want to say that they need some psychological help, right? Let's see. Senator Richard Lugar, an Indiana Republican and chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, criticized the administration's handling of Iraq's reconstruction. Only a billion of $18.5 billion allocated by Congress for the task has been spent. Lugar said, this is incompetence in the administration. This isn't, Democrats. Now, John Kerry has accused the Bush administration, did this yesterday, of secretly planning to call up a substantial number of military reservists and National Guard units after Election Day to go to Iraq. Again, this web of lies. So here's what Kerry says, that as soon as Bush wins the election, because he's going to pop this October surprise where they're going to be fighting terrorism at home, and they're going to bomb Iran, and they're going to find Saddam Hussein. Excuse me, they got him. Osama bin Forgotten. Now, Kerry told people in Albuquerque, he won't tell us what congressional leaders are now saying, that this administration is planning yet another substantial call-up of reservists and guard units immediately after the election. Kerry says, hide it from the people through the election, then make the move. That's not the way we do business in the United States of America. Well, we do under George Bush. We deserve a president who tells the American people the truth. And when it comes to Iraq, George W. Bush simply won't own up to the truth. So, now here is Bush. Now, you got to figure this all out. Now, all the partisans are saying, oh, yeah, Bush lies, so that's no revelation. And all of you, some of you, the Republicans that are listening, oh, that's just a lot of Kerry partisan crap-a-roo. In fact, White House spokesman Scott McClellan said he blasted the suggestion of a new reservist call-up as, quote, just another baseless attack. Well, where's all the rest of them? So we're sort of left hanging. Kerry says there's going to be a huge call-up of the Reserve and the National Guard. The president's spokesman, I don't like to call him that, George W. Bush's spokesman said it's another baseless attack. How do we figure out? Well, one of the things that the Republicans are saying, let's see if I circled that. McCain said we've got to take out the sanctuaries. And in the New York Times, it says, U.S. plans year-end drive to take Iraqi rebel areas. Faced with a growing insurgency, things aren't getting better. The insurgency is growing. It's not getting less. The puppet government installed by United States Army, as they used to say, bayonets, entering the country with the rationale of weapons of mass destruction, are losing. A January deadline for national elections is in place. American commanders in Iraq say they are preparing operations to open up rebel-held areas, particularly in Fallujah, the rest of city west of Baghdad, now under control of insurgents and Islamist groups. A senior American commander said the military intended to take back Fallujah and other rebel areas by year's end. And there's lots of them. Ramadi, a provincial capital in El Anbar province, only a tenuous grip over another one, Bakuba, the capital of, they got a lot of them here, I don't know, Diyala, province northeast of Baghdad. Other large cities in the regions like Samarra are largely in the hands of insurgents. So after all this blood, after all this destruction, after all this enormous waste of $200 billion, the richest country, the most powerful country, the strongest military in the world, has all these regions that are largely in the hands of insurgents. There's an average of 87 attacks a day, a string of deadly attacks. So what's going to happen here? So that makes some sense. If they're going to plan this year-end drive to take back Iraqi rebel areas, it would make some sense that, in fact, that Bush plans a huge call-up, exactly like Kerry says, and Scott McClellan is lying, that it's just another baseless attack. How are they going to do it? Well, if they go in with military might, what they're going to do, of course, is they're going to kill a lot of Iraqi civilians, just like they've been doing. The most senior U.S. military officers now believe the war on Iraq has turned into a disaster on an unprecedented scale. Unfortunately, this is in the Guardian of London. Retired General Joseph Hoare, H-O-A-R-E, the former Marine Commandant and head of U.S. Central Command, told Sidney Blumenthal of The Guardian, the idea that this is going to go the way these guys planned is ludicrous. There are no good options. We're conducting a campaign as though it were being conducted in Iowa. No sense of the realities on the ground. It's so unrealistic for anyone who knows that part of the world. The priorities are just all wrong. Let's see. Retired General William Odom, former head of the National Security Agent, said Bush has not found the WMD, Al-Qaeda, its worst. He's lost on that front. That he's going to achieve a democracy there, that goal is lost, too. It's lost. He said, right now, the course we're on, we're achieving bin Laden's goals. What about Osama bin Forgotten? According to the Times, CIA unit on bin Laden is understaffed. 3 years after the September 11th attacks on New York and the Pentagon, the CIA has fewer experienced case officers assigned to its headquarters unit dealing with Osama bin Laden than it did at the time of the attacks. There's no systematic effort to create al-Qaeda expertise, it says. The bin Laden unit is stretched so thin that it relies on inexperienced officers. That's because everything is has been generated towards not losing in Iraq. Richard Nixon, that criminal Republican, said, "I will not be the first American president to preside over a losing war." Again, the largest army in the world. We inflicted 3 million deaths on those people, taking back cities from the insurgents, doing everything imaginable short of atomic weapons. And the United States lost. Same thing is possible in Iraq under George W. Bush. And some of you out there are saying, let's give him more of a shot at this? A guy that won't even tell us the truth? Man. Dana, we're going to line 5. All right, thanks. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
A couple questions, a couple things, topics of discussion. One thing I always wonder, like, around election time, it seems that no one ever talks about, like, congressional elections, and, I mean, I'm definitely related to presidential, but a lot of what happens in Washington has to do with Congress and guys that can be in there, like, John Thurman, for example, for like a million years.
Right.
You know, they're representing, I mean, they're really what's supposed to be representing the people, right? You know what I'm saying? They make the laws, and some of them, I mean, that's, I think, where a lot of the crooked politics, if you want to call them that, you know what I mean? And nobody ever talks about that.
Mm-hmm.
So what are your thoughts on that subject?
Well, this actually been kind of holding back this email, and you're absolutely right. Someone signing it, Rizpa, writes in to calltalk@yahoo.com. He said, I heard that a long time ago there was a vote. Boy, there was a vote when 90% of the Congress was voted out of office because they gave themselves a raise. Well, that, I don't think that ever happened. I think we should vote all the people out of office. We should vote for independent candidates in all the offices and let the politicians know who has the real power in the U.S. Vote them all out. Well, I don't know. You got to get some alternatives in there, right?
Yeah, that's kind of, you know, I just think it's the term limits maybe or something. I don't know. I just think it's long overdue term limits for Congress.
Yeah, one thing that's nice, like in Vermont, they have a, well, two, where's the other guy from? Oh, yeah, from Vermont as well. They have an independent, Bernie Sanders in the House of Representatives, not a Republican or a Democrat. And also, what's his name, Jim Jeffords, who's also an independent as well, that left the Republican Party. All right, thank you very much. But you're right.
Hey, can I get you one more question?
Yeah, sure.
I'm a college student right now. I go to Eastern Michigan University, which is, look out, you know, all the troubles there. But I'm going into music education, and I'm wondering how you feel about what's all happening with the schools right now and the huge financial disaster that is the public school system in this state right now.
Well, we have to make some priorities. Either we got to fight oil wars in Iraq for a Bush empire, or we can fund our schools. And I'm sure you know the situation that's happening. I mean, what classes are being cut, right? Music classes.
Exactly.
Well, I don't know. Not really into giving occupation advice, but it's a worthy cause that you've taken up, and I'd hate to see you have to turn away from that because we've spent all our money on a foreign war.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Bye now. Ed from Warren writes in the calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He saw on CNN that if the world could vote in the American presidential election, Kerry would win an overwhelming landslide. I think he won in Poland, the Philippines, close race in India and Thailand. Yet half of Americans want Bush. Yeah, there's something real wrong there. All righty, let's go on. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening. It's Peter Werby.
Peter, this is Chris. I've been listening to you for off and on for about 18 years.
Wow, great.
And you've got just an absolutely awesome show.
Thank you. Thanks for being part of it for so long.
Yeah, we've spoken many times before about different political issues and things like this, but tonight I'm calling for a slightly different reason. We own Infinite Path Martial Arts over in Clawson.
Okay.
And we are hosting our second annual winter charity drive. And we are asking for donations of canned and dried foods and any and all winter clothing. And all donations will be distributed through the Salvation Army in Royal Oak. And they can bring any donation to Infinite Path Martial Arts, which is in the Hunter Community Center in Clawson. That's a few blocks north of 14 Mile, east off of Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to run through December 10th. Last year we raised over 500 items, and this year we're hoping for a whole lot more.
Great. That's wonderful.
Any questions, people can call us at 248-336-8488. Or visit our website, www.infinitepath.net.
What styles do you teach?
Well, we teach a philosophy of Kung Fu,
mm-hmm.
and we have separate programs for kids and adults. And what we focus on is martial arts as a discipline of the mind and body for personal growth and self-discovery. We work together as partners, not opponents. So the learning is safer, faster, and far more enjoyable. And we cover long range, close range, grappling, joint locks, chokes, throws, weapons, with an emphasis on meditation. So we're working on the person from within.
That's good. I mean, I've taken martial arts, geez, for the last, at least the last 18 years since you've been listening. Although, as I've marched along on my path, I've switched out of hard styles of karate into Tai Chi Chuan, Yang style.
Yeah, I have some Tai Chi experience. We teach primarily a soft art. We use the other partner's energy against them, so
sure.
It doesn't matter how big or strong you are. And I think that fits in with our philosophical base much better than a hard style.
Yeah, with all due respect to other styles, it certainly fits mine now. But dissolving other people's aggressive energies. Wouldn't that be nice? Actually, the founder of our school, who founded it like in 1938, he saw Tai Chi, not besides having its martial abilities and all of its other health and auxiliary benefits, he saw it as a world transformative philosophy, so much in the same way.
Yeah, and that's pretty much our mission.
Good.
Is to get people in there and have them discover not just how to defend themselves, but higher qualities that we can apply in our everyday lives as well as a society.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks for letting me mention that, Peter. Keep up the great work.
Yeah, and same with you guys. It's good to know that you're doing good work in the community. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks.
Appreciate it, Chris. Bye-bye now. Joe from Canton writes in to calltalk@yahoo.com. I was driving today, and I came up to a van with a bumper sticker reading, "Put an end to terror. Defeat Bush." Okay, let's take another call. Hi, it's WRIF, 313-298-WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, I've got to get off the I think I have to turn my radio off. You made the comment that you were talking about terror. And you indicated that if the issue is terror, Bush wins. Well, I'd like to say that, unfortunately, I believe that your program, you've wasted a lot of time in not talking about 9/11. Alternative theories have just been, you usually refer to them in as conspiracy theories, and it's you're helping to elect Bush. I'm amazed that you did not announce on your program here this. That I can see over at Rents, an article at Rents.com talked about government. It's titled "Government Insider Says Bush Authorized 9/11 Attacks." And this guy's name is Stanley Hilton. He was a senior advisor to Senator Bob Dole. He has personally known Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz for decades. This guy has launched a massive lawsuit involving RICO claims against the government over the 9/11, and his claim is, and he makes no, he doesn't mince words about it. He says they just didn't allow it to happen. Bush ordered it. He personally ordered it. He says this with great assurance. People should look at Rens.com and look for this, but you have helped elect Bush by ignoring this alternative theories. Wait a minute now.
You have some responsibility in the matter. I mean, you're saying, like, I didn't announce this. I didn't even know. First off, I didn't have any knowledge of this particular person or what they've charged. I certainly have heard the general charge that it wasn't just a matter, as I've said, that that they knew an attack was coming and they had plans to respond exactly in the manner that they have. So in that sense, they're responsible. And even if they didn't know any of this, Bush is responsible for September 11th by misfeasance. That you're saying it's malfeasance. Misfeasance is enough. His own commission, his handpicked 911 commission, said that they did not, Clinton neither, but Clinton wasn't in office. Bush was in office, and he dropped the ball. The worst intelligence failure in American history that resulted in 3,000 lives. That should have been enough to drive him from office. If that's not harsh enough for you. See, if you can bring this, these charges that Bush ordered September 11th to put forth adequate proofs, good. I mean, but there's enough every day on the front page of the paper that ought to be enough to sink Bush. And the September 11th, if you read the September 11th commission, that ought to be enough to defeat Bush, to know that in their hands, in Bushko's hands, that none of us are secure. So, and does the charge that he ordered it sound wild to me? Yeah, I think it's pretty wild. But I wouldn't put anything past those guys.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah. Well, all right. May I respond? I would say this. No, it means a lot different to the Americans. First of all, it's worthless to refer to the 9/11 Commission report. Remember, Bush handpicked those people, and if you read their personal statements, they weren't even interested in finding out who was to blame. They wanted these general conclusions. That is a whitewash.
Sure.
I mean, you can put it right up there with the Warren Commission report.
Now, well, wait a minute. There's enough in the September 11th Commission to provide the basis of a demand that Bush and all of them should have resigned, because it was their inaction after they had received warning after warning after warning that something was going to occur and did absolutely nothing. Bush went off on vacation. Why isn't that enough just to blow them out of office?
Not enough, because, you see, when people understand that these guys just didn't let it happen, they actually designed it. They financed it, and they made it happen. Now, that is a complete, that's order of magnitudes worse. And if most of your listeners could be persuaded, or at least were informed that this is out there, these ideas are out there, that would make Bush all the worse. He shouldn't just resign. He's a traitor. He deserves to be tried, along with Wolfowitz and Pearl. This whole Israeli Zionist gang that has infected the government. That's another issue, by the way, that your program hasn't really zeroed in on enough. This Israeli spy issue should be a major topic on your program. They are tied in with Bush. They are the people who were the architects of this 9/11, and the Bush administration went along with it. And it makes a big difference in my mind that he just didn't sleep at the stick. He actually ordered it.
All right. Well, you're making the same contention over and over again. All right, I'll check that out. I often have felt uncomfortable with some of the charges on Rens.com, R-E-N-S-E, by the way, R-E-N-S-E.com. And it even, from time to time, has a flavor to it that I don't like and almost sounds like you're edging a bit into it. But I'll check it out. All right, thanks for calling. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
It's all 12-foot Bilderberger lizards that graduated from Yale and the Skull and Crossbone Society. I tell you that right now, Peter.
Well, hey, there are conspiracies in this society. I mean, one of the things that happens is that people, that the idea that something is a conspiracy theory denigrates it to the point of it being fanciful. I mean, I think there was a conspiracy to, for instance, long ago to assassinate John F. Kennedy. But if you don't agree with the Warren Commission, you're a conspiracy nut.
The former caller is actually right. Bush did finance it, but it was Bush's father giving money, you know, as vice president with Reagan, to the Afghani resistance that created Osama bin, you know, Osama, as you put it, bin forgotten.
Yeah, well, also, you got to remember that Bushko demanded that, I think it's 27 pages of his own commission's report on September 11th not be released, and it's the senator from Florida, remind me his name, please.
Bob Graham.
Bob Graham, that in his new book says that's all about the Saudi financing of the September 11th.
There was a congressman from Texas named Charlie Wilson, a real colorful character.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he was a fan of Israel. He loved Israel. You know, and then he came across in the early 80s, he came across the Afghani resistance. And he somehow tried to engineer, you know, the Israelis and the Saudis into financing Afghanistan. And it ties in, you know, you were talking about the October surprise. You know, it ties in with the, you know, well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, why philosophical rabbits don't live very long. You know, they all tied into that. And then Charlie Wilson became the main congressional conduit for funds going to the Afghanis.
Yeah,
there's a really good book called Charlie Wilson's War about the, you know, the whole early funding of the Afghanistan resistance against Russia.
Well, see, the problem with all of this is that it sounds so labyrinthine, and it is. And the connections between people with power and people with money and, like, for instance, the connection between the Bushes and the Saudis and all this international financing, stuff that goes back into the 80s, some stuff that goes back even further, people begin to glaze over because it's a little hard to even perceive, particularly on radio. And when you, if you read it, keeping track of it all is an extraordinary challenge. But it's out there. And there are conspiracies. A lot of times use Alexander Coburn's father's phrase, to kind of paraphrase it, actually. The world is run it's run by a conspiracy of men who often don't even meet. In other words, they know what their interests are, and they want to maintain their extraordinary wealth and their extraordinary power over all of us. So they don't even have to meet. They don't even have to sit down. Sometimes they do. Sometimes that list that you ran off of Bilderbergers and Club of Rome and whoever else, the Bohemian Club or whatever, these are where the wealthy and the power sit down and decide our futures. Okay, thank you very much. We will return.
Time is running out. Time is running out on the best deal ever, on your opportunity to make an investment that can help you make more money, that will change your life forever. Time is running out on your chance to register for Oakland Community College's fall 2004 semester. Final walk-in registration for fall classes is on August 30th and September 1st. Register on the web or visit any of OCC's 5 convenient campuses to sign up for your choice of thousands of day, night, and weekend classes in literally hundreds of subjects like business, psychology, computer information systems, physics, English, pre-engineering, robotics, and more. If you want to take a giant step to a better life, Oakland Community College is your educational answer. Call or visit your local OCC campus now. They're in Auburn Hills, Waterford, Farmington Hills, Royal Oak, and Southfield. Remember, final walk-in registration is August 30th and September 1st. Oakland Community College. Get anywhere from here.
Fall classes begin September 2nd. Get your clubs ready and head out to Treetops Resort. Treetops, located in Gaylord, Michigan, is home to the number one par 3 course in the U.S. Treetops is proud to be rated the top golf course to play by Golf Magazine, as well as being recognized as being a silver medal award winner. Also ranked by USA Today as the top 10 places to take dad, this is certainly a place where you need to be. There are 4 unforgettable courses, 3 of them designed by top-notch golfers. So call now and make certain you're able to take in the incredible sights of Treetops Resort. Call 1-888-TREETOPS. That's 1-888-TREETOPS. Be sure to ask for the WRIF Stay and Play offer for just $99 during the month of August. That's 1-888-TREETOPS for this special price. Oh, and when you call, make sure you ask for the great prices on ski packages available for this winter. Offer subject to availability. Some restrictions apply. The $99 stay-and-play offer won't last forever, so call now. 1-888-TREETOPS.
This is WRIM.com.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
What the hell does Detroit want with Arkansas?
Well, you know, just same old thing. Shoot the breeze, you know.
Damn, I ain't got time to mess you damn people up there. I got work to do here, and you keep calling, raising hell with me. What's the matter? Every week or...
Well, you become an important part of the program, Delbert. It's actually should be a compliment.
Yeah.
What the hell does Michigan want with Arkansas?
I guess this is the first time we've run into you in a bad mood.
Well, you know, I guess everybody gets that once in a while after so much irritation.
Yeah.
Did something happen the last time we talked?
No, I don't reckon. This is the way it has to be, I guess. Let me tell you one thing before you hang up.
All right.
This is an April Fool's joke on you bastards.
You crotchety old curmudgeon.
I always knew you were bastard, but man, oh man.
Drew and Mike in the morning. Broadcast program. On the Riff. 101-101. W-R-I-F. Riff. All day Thursday, your walk right in free station. 101, The Riff unleashes a ticket blitz Thursday. Keep your radio locked on 101 WRIF all day this Thursday for your chance to hook up with tickets to all of the hottest concerts and events happening around the Motor City. Hooking you up like no other Detroit station can. Listen for your chance to win. Then call the Riff request line at 313-298-WRIF.
Don't forget.
You can always improve your chances to win by joining the Riff Cyber Crew today and score your totally unfair internet advantage.
Just log on to WRIF.com.
It's Ticket Blitz Thursday on the Riff. All day Thursday from your walk right in free station. 101. The Riff.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
Bill Clinton proving one more time he'll talk to anybody for a crumb of attention as he talked to us again.
What about Jennifer Flowers? I mean, do you regret lying about her on 60 Minutes?
No, I don't. I don't think so. No.
Well, why not?
Because I wanted to get elected, and I just felt like if the nation...
You're always complaining. Always complaining.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. Here's one of these nasty little Nazis sent this email to me. And the reason I say that, because one of the things that fascists want to do is they want to stop all dissent, right? And here's what it's all about. I mean, half of this is okay. Hi there. Alex writes this into calltalkus@yahoo.com. Calltalkus@yahoo.com. I just wanted to let you know that you've caused me to remove WRIF, sadly, from all my presets after decades of support because of your incessant Bush bashing. So you don't get to hear Meltdown or Arthur P. or Drew and Mike or anything like that because I'm on 2 hours. So this is pretty typical. You should know better than to be inflammatory towards 50% of a radio station's listeners. Alex, you are so out of it. I mean, to think that half of Riff listeners support Bush. I mean, I think it'd be lucky if it's about 20 or 25%. And now here is the real kicker. By the way, I've sent WRIF word of this as well. So Doug Podell, my boss, my pal, somebody I've been on the air with for a couple of decades, he's going to say, oh, Alex has wrote us and said he doesn't have a presets anymore. You're out of here. Sorry. But see, this guy is trying to stop this show. He's trying to stop dissent. This is typical of these Bushies, who are at core fascist. And that's what I said, politics fascist, personality bully. How can he get somebody bigger and stronger to stop someone that he doesn't like, when he doesn't like what they're doing? Me. So he doesn't call up to 313-298-WRIF and say, you know, I disagree with you. Or why do you incessantly bash Bush? Well, one of the reasons I incessantly bash Bush is to give some balance to the free ride that this absolute failed presidency has gotten from the corporate and particularly from the right-wing mainstream press, corporate press. So, Alex, you're a pathetic excuse for a human being. All right. And if you don't like me saying that, give a call. That's what it's all about, man. It's about exchange of ideas. I mean, he's the kind of guy that if they fired me, they'd say, oh, no, Alex is changing his presets. We better get rid of Werby. And he put on some far-right winger that defended Bush. Do you think he would write in and say then, oh, this is unbalanced. I'm removing my presets. He would sit there and get stroked. But doesn't care that in this incredible liberal city, in this incredible liberal area, in this liberal state, that we are subjected to the right-wing ravings of these conservatives on talk radio day in and day out, hour after hour, and then we get 2 hours to say the opposite, and he's removing his presets. Jesus. These guys are fascists. He's in the fascist third. All right. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter. It's Dan from Ann Arbor. That was pretty funny, actually, what you were just saying about Alex. I've listened to you over the years, and I have a couple of things to say. I'd really like to ask that I don't get muted out or,
No guarantees.
I don't want to be forbidden from talking.
No guarantees. Go ahead.
Well, see what you can do. But, the first thing is that, objectively, you don't ever seem happy with whoever's in the White House.
There you go. Wait till Kerry wins, and I'll be bashing him big time.
Why don't you bash him now? What are you waiting for?
Well, he hasn't done anything.
Well, no, he's done plenty.
He's non-Bush. I mean, that's the right. Best thing he's got going for him. He is not going to destroy the environment. Hopefully he's not going to launch any wars. He's not going to give tax breaks to the wealthy. He's not going to put in these far right-wing psychos into positions of importance. He's not going to put lobbyists for polluting industries into regulatory agencies that govern the industries that they came from.
Out here.
What's
don't
that?
Mute me out.
Don't tell me how to run the show, okay? I'll mute you out so that we can both talk. You're muted out now. Go ahead. Now you're not.
All right. How do you think he's going to handle the terrorist threat?
I have no idea. Listen, I was thinking about that. Anybody could handle the terrorist threat as long as they were focused on that. The reason Bush hasn't been able to handle this is because, for one thing, he manipulates it in order to keep us in a state of fear so we can't think about all the other issues. Also, rather than dealing with the terrorist threat, he launches this war based on lies against Iraq. So as I just read, that rather than having this big focus on Osama bin Laden and doing basic international police work to stop this from occurring again, CIA unit on bin Laden is understaffed. What the hell do you make of that?
So Bushko fabricated the intelligence from the Russian intelligence agency.
Well, you've been listening. Which one of these right-wing talk show hosts always talks about this stuff. It never occurred to you that maybe if the Russians, in fact, did give that they were doing that to gull the United States, that we're talking with a guy, as that website says, TooStupidToBePresident.com?
All right. Okay. Fair enough.
All right. How come when he gets a message saying Al-Qaeda to strike in U.S., he goes on vacation? I mean, his brain was already on vacation, but he actually took the leadership of the United States, and when there is this imminent threat, he goes on vacation.
All right. Well, let me put it this way.
Go ahead.
Do you think we've diminished any sort of terrorist threat at all? Like, be objective, Peter. Be objective. Think about it.
No.
Do you think? No, not at all.
No, in fact, we've increased it. Well, wait a minute. We lost 3,000 people on September 11th. Because of Bush's efforts, we've lost another 1,000 dead and 7,000 seriously wounded. So there's that right there. Also, I don't, maybe you didn't hear me before, all of these generals, Marines and commandants of, I forgot what their titles were, have all said that this has done Osama bin Laden the biggest favor in the world, because even if Al-Qaeda isn't even existing, there are so many people now that hate the United States even more. And this is not, this doesn't bother Bushko, because the fact that we take a little hit here and now, or now and again, just means that that reinforces their priorities and the agenda that was set a long time ago.
So you're going to cut me off now, right?
No, now you're talking.
All right.
Well, do me a favor. Now you're cut off. Dan, stop with all of this. Talk when you can. All right? That's the way talk shows are run. Listen to the right-wing talk shows. You can tell that very frequently after they get one or two sentences out, they're gone. So right now, you are potted down, as the phrase goes. And right now, you are up. So go ahead.
Well, I listen to the left and the right and the middle. And everyone's talking about that the number one issue is the war on terror, all right? Now, it would be nice to believe that, you know, the number one issue is health care, because I need it too.
Right.
I work for myself. I'm self-employed. And, you know, it'd be nice to believe that, but, you know, Peter, I live in Ann Arbor, and, you know, every time there's a Michigan game, you know, I can throw a rock and hit the Michigan stadium. Every time there's a Michigan game, I wonder. You know, I mean, I wonder.
You do.
Well,
you must be wondering a lot. I mean, there are. I'm sorry, I cut myself off. There's large crowd. There's large crowd activities all the time, and I mean, you are evidence of the fear that that have been instilled purposely into us by Bushko. Now, in other countries, people take safeguards. They're wary. But one of the things that you see happens, like, for instance, in Israel, is that people say, well, you know, I'm not going to have my life, you know, to just be stunted by the possibility, the real possibility of attacks on us. And there is no way really to stop terrorism. The only thing that Bush ever said, and of course he just slipped out because he was unscripted, said you can't win the war on terror. Yeah, you can't. Or, I mean, maybe it takes like a generation, as it did with the IRA. But what we have to do is, on one hand, is to have good security, is to track down these criminals, and not to get diverted the way that Iraq was a diversion from finding Osama bin Laden. In fact, the United States was taking equipment out of Afghanistan and sending it to Iraq when there was absolutely no need to, because Bush and all of them knew there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Well, let me just say one thing. You brought up Israel and their, you know, efforts against terrorism. They're the first ones to have locking, you know, cockpit doors. We followed in suit after 9/11. Now, the other thing, as far as Afghanistan and Iraq goes, is that are you upset that Saddam Hussein's out of power? Are you upset by that?
You know, this is very typical of a right-wing question. That you can, it's one of those things, have you stopped beating your wife? Because, and when you try to explain a long, in a long answer, the purpose of it is to say, why isn't he just saying yes? Saddam Hussein is this evil man. What I prefer is a much longer question, because, as I have frequently said, it takes a second to tie a knot and it can take an hour to untie it. The reason that there are so many unsolvable problems in this world, including Osama bin Laden, including Saddam Hussein, is because of the catastrophic errors made by American foreign policy over since World War II. And it's a matter of chickens coming home to roost. Saddam Hussein was our chicken. We armed him. or I should say, Reagan and Papa Bush armed him. He was our great ally. He was a pawn against Iran. And two of them, of course, who couldn't give a crap about human life, were presided over this war that's in between Iran and Iraq that took a million lives. And then he became a lot more useful as an enemy. So he was set up and then destroyed, and then hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have lost their lives because of the sanctions. And then someone wants to ask me or John Kerry, how do we solve this problem? Well, why the hell doesn't somebody ask George W. Bush, how do we solve this problem? Because he has no exit strategy whatsoever except kill more people.
I don't believe that.
Well,
and you know what? I have to tell you, Peter, I'm not right-wing. I'm not out there, you know, just listening to right wing. I'm not Christian. I'm not anything. Seriously, I'm trying to find the truth here. And what I'm seeing is that I think you're out there not being as objective as you could be, because you're an extremely intelligent person, and I think you could be more objective. And I don't think that you need to go into the Michael Moore left wing, you know, Bush Co. Saudi, you know.
Well, it's all there. I don't understand even what objective means. I mean, listen, this is a talk show, and I like to talk like this, but you can listen to, I mean, I could do an NPR, National Public Radio style show. I mean, I'm capable of doing that. I suppose if my boss came to me and said, look, you have to not say Bush Co., and you can't call him a liar and stuff like that, it's something that he would never do, I could, I don't know if I would still do the show, but I could do it. I could say I disagree strongly with the policies on Iraq of George W. Bush, that it turned out that much of what he has he stated turned out to not be the case, and it's actually my opinion that he knew that it was not the case, rather than calling him a liar, although I don't know, that's not so unusual anymore. Do me a favor, and you get the, give me the last, your last thought in short order.
Okay, you know, basically, I have a lot of respect for you, and I just think you could be a little more objective, like I said in the previous statement. And I don't, you know, I'm not a Bush supporter, I'm not a Kerry supporter. I think it's unusual pulling, you know, Bush out of it right when he's in the middle of perhaps maybe handling it. I think we've diminished the terrorist threat a little bit. I think we've struck Al-Qaeda, you know, where it hurts. You know, and I don't know. You know, I think Kerry will be strong on terrorism. You know, I think he'll do a decent job too. But, you know, I mean, we're at the point right now where, you know, I mean, I don't want the Ren Sen taken down. I don't want, you know.
I don't think it'll be taken down. So you're saying essentially don't change horses in midstream. All right. Thank you. Appreciate it. Actually, stay. You're down, but here, this, I wasn't even going to read this, but Todd writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, I was driving on 696 and came up behind a horse, behind a truck with a horse trailer with two horses in tow. As I got a little closer, I noticed that the trailer had a Bush Cheney sticker on it. I'm not sure if the driver had intentionally put that sticker on the trailer as a pun or not, but I did find it as a funny visual to see two horses' asses and then see a Bush Cheney sticker. So there you go with don't change horses. All right, thank you. Appreciate your call, Dan from Ann Arbor, A Square. Daryl writes in, I've tried educating a Bush supporter with logic and reason, even printed some facts and articles from your site and others. You somehow become to them a propagandist, liar, and un-American. Yeah, sometimes people say, what do I say to my dad, or what do I say to my friend? Or, you know, at some point, you just got to say goodbye. Yeah, I mean, they don't want facts. They're not interested in that. It's what's one of the phrases for it? A mass personnel. Oh, it's not even. All of a sudden, I'm forgetting my phrases. Mass. But anyways, they just want to. It's sort of the Stockholm syndrome. They identify with power. They, remember this when somewhere in Stockholm, these kidnappers, these. They're holding people hostages, and the hostages began to identify with the kidnappers. So it's called the Stockholm syndrome. That's a lot of what the Bush support is all about. Let's take another call. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Pete. It's Howard from Grass Lake.
Hi, Howard.
Hey, I ran across a video. It's done by Dave Von Kleist. It's regarding the events of 9/11,
mm-hmm.
And prior to the collapse of the Pentagon. Shows that there's a 15-foot hole that was impossible to be made by an airplane that was in it prior to the collapse. And then he checks out what went on in New York, and it shows a real large cloud of smoke, approximately 60 stories high, rising to the north of the buildings before they went down. No explanation. That was only shown once on national TV, and it was hidden from us.
Sure. Well, a lot of it, too. Let me just interrupt you half a sec. I mean, I was just looking at some stuff the other day that said it's improbable that there was enough burn, although we hear how hot it was, the jet fuel burning, that it was burning in black smoke, which indicates a lower temperature than was even possible to do to create what finally occurred. But then, I mean, essentially you're left with that these planes didn't hit the Trade Tower, or that they hit them and that there were explosives inside, but I don't know.
That's one of the things he shows. When these planes, just prior to them hitting the building, there's a flash. Could be a missile. It could be something to ignite the fuel once they hit. That's never been shown on TV that we know about. He's using the actual footage from CNN, Fox, and all this.
Well, here's my thought on that, Howard. There are so many people that do not believe the actual events that are portrayed officially about September 11th, that it shows this great distrust in government, even about an issue as crucial to us as this. And so either way, it says something about what we've experienced. All right, I got to get one more call real quickly, and so thank you for yours. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, this is Ron from Romulus, Michigan.
Hi, Ron.
Yeah, I caught a C-SPAN program, I think about 2 weeks ago. They were talking about the security and defense goals or future goals here in America, and they kind of alluded to the fact as China is being this big motivator of why the Middle East is such a central concern is because of the oil coming out of the Middle East toward China and then becoming a superpower in the next 15 to 20 years. So the idea is to limit how much fuel and try and keep China in check as a world power. And I just want to get your thoughts and comments on that if you come across anything of that.
Well, I mean, I don't think I have to do it. I mean, that I think it sums it up very, very well. And in fact, I don't know whether you're going to stay up any, but in about 5 minutes, I'm going to air an interview with a man named Richard Heinberg.
Yes.
You know of him?
Yes. In fact, I think his name was mentioned on the program itself. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And he talks about the consequences of maintaining this carbon-based fuel system.
That's another thing they mentioned on that program as well. The 20-year span for America itself was to go to hydrogen. But you know, the idea is to still limit China's power in the world.
Well, I mean, he says, I don't know, I hate to admit this on the air, but I'm a little bit distracted because I'm trying to put in all this stuff into this system we have here, and it ain't really working. We'll see. In fact, Richard Heinberg, and he says that we talk about alternative fuels, fuel cells and wind power and solar power. He says there's actually not, that you cannot have a world that wants to power itself in the manner that we talk about with what's...
Yeah, the sheer population itself would just collapse upon itself with the technologies that we're running right now.
Indeed. All right. Thank you for being more articulate than I was. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for being our last caller. All right. I think I've got this together. Now, this is an unusual situation here, not what I was just talking about. I guess the technology here is working. We're going to have this interview with Richard Heinberg, and my other interview has disappeared. My fault. Somewhere. So I'm going to play at 1:30 a program called Counterspin. It's put together by FAIR, FAIR.org, FAIR.org. So that's what we're going to hear. That's the lineup for the next hour. So thank you for listening. Thank you for calling. Stay tuned. A lot more going on.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Get your clubs ready and head out to Treetops Resort. Treetops, located in Gaylord, Michigan, is home to the number one par 3 course in the U.S. Treetops is proud to be rated the top golf course to play by Golf Magazine, as well as being recognized as being a Silver Medal Award winner. Also ranked by USA Today as the top 10 places to take dad, this is certainly a place where you need to be. There are 4 unforgettable courses, 3 of them designed by top-notch golfers. So call now and make certain you're able to take in the incredible sights of Treetops Resort. Call 1-888-TREETOPS. That's 1-888-TREETOPS. Be sure to ask for the WRIF Stay and Play offer for just $99 during the month of August. That's 1-888-TREETOPS for this special price. Oh, and when you call, make sure you ask for the great prices on ski packages available for this winter. Offer subject to availability, some restrictions apply. The $99 Stay and Play offer won't last forever, so call now. 1-888-TREETOPS.
Time is running out. Time is running out on the best deal ever. On your opportunity to make an investment that can help you make more money, that will change your life forever. Time is running out on your chance to register for Oakland Community College's fall 2004 semester. Final walk-in registration for fall classes is on August 30th and September 1st. Register on the web or visit any of OCC's 5 convenient campuses to sign up for your choice of thousands of day, night, and weekend classes in literally hundreds of subjects like business, psychology, computer information systems, physics, English, pre-engineering, robotics, and more. If you want to take a giant step to a better life, Oakland Community College is your educational answer. Call or visit your local OCC campus now. They're in Auburn Hills, Waterford, Farmington Hills, Royal Oak, and Southfield. Remember, final walk-in registration is August 30th and September 1st. Oakland Community College. Get anywhere from here.
Fall classes begin September 2nd. This is WRIF.com.
Hello, how are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We talked to Gene Simmons of KISS. And of course, we had to ask about Peter and our dear friend Ace.
They're both sweethearts. Hopefully, they're taking care of their health, which is more important than being on tour in a rock band.
Well, there's just so many comical aspects to him also. Just the business of him, that he likes to take things apart, but he rarely puts them back together again. And
I've given him a few cell phones. You know, if they didn't, if they had a click or something, yeah, let me fix it. He tears them apart and goes, oh, that's what the inside looks like.
Yeah.
I go, okay, can I have it back? It's not working.
Not a chance. There's no way that cell phone's going back together again.
You don't let him do that in your studio, do you?
I stopped letting him do lots of stuff.
Drew and Mike in the Morning. Broadcast program. On the Riff.
Riff.
Every Tuesday, 101 WRIF,
the home of rock and roll,
brings you Two for Tuesday. Keep it locked on the Riff all day this Tuesday for back-to-back badass blasts of your favorite riff rock band.
Plus, the Riff gives you the hottest tickets to the coolest concerts and events happening around the Motor City.
Two for Tuesday.
Double the Riff.
To put all our eggs in the basket of hydrocarbon fuel. In fact, I'm really probably understating it. Now, Richard Heinberg is back with another book. It's called Powered Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. And Richard Heinberg, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter.
Is Time Flying and I'm Not Realizing? It was last year that the party's over.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Anything that has happened in between then and when we last spoke that altered any of your conclusions in that book?
Well, yes, actually quite a lot has happened. We've seen oil prices rise dramatically. They've cooled off a bit in the last 3 weeks or so, but the general trend has been remarkable for a lot of people are sort of scratching their heads now and saying, you know, what the hell is happening with oil? And so a lot of articles have come out in magazines and newspapers, including the cover story in the June National Geographic, The End of Cheap Oil, the cover story of Fortune magazine, and articles in New York Times, LA Times, and all over the place. So a lot more people are aware now that there is a problem with oil. And then the other thing that's happened since then is that a lot of really disturbing information has come in suggesting that the global oil peak could happen much sooner than even some of us pessimists were saying. And the party's over, I was saying between probably, 2006 and 2015. And now the signs are suggesting that global oil peak could be upon us virtually immediately, anytime between now and about 2008, 2009, at the outside. And what's the information that's telling us this is, first of all, 2003 turned out to be the worst year for new discoveries of oil since the early 1920s. I mean, virtually nothing was found. No new giant well of 500 million barrels or more, which is kind of, I mean, there hasn't been a year in modern history when at least one new giant well wasn't discovered until last year. And then going forward, the new projects that were discovered before then that are going to come online in coming years are pretty few and not too ambitious. We have new projects coming online in off the coast of Brazil, off the coast of West Africa, and the Gulf of Mexico. These are all deep water wells. And if you add all of those up, they amount to about 5 to 7 million barrels a day of new production that's likely to come on stream between now and about 2008. But now we're looking at about 1 to 2 million barrels per day of added demand each year from now until the kingdom come, plus an increasing bite coming as a result of depletion of existing reserves. In other words, we're seeing most of the giant oil wells that are providing the bulk of our current production, about 60% of our current production is from old supergiant oil fields like Ghawar in Saudi Arabia and Cantarell in Mexico and Dachang in China and so on. Those are almost all in decline right now. They're aging fields that are in secondary recovery. And there's just nothing coming on to take their place.
That's what you mean when you say that, well, peak oil for the whole world. These particular wells have already peaked. I mean, they're still producing.
That's right.
But they've passed their peak. Actually, I am remiss in not mentioning that Richard Heinberg, besides being the author of the brand new book, Power Down: Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World, published by New Society Publishers. You can go to newsociety.com. I'll also have this information on my website. Is also the author of The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies. He's a member of the faculty at the New College of California, and he's written numerous articles about energy resources, the dynamics of cultural change for many years. Okay, now we've got all your creds in there properly. We'll go back to the book. Now, countries like China, I mean, most so-called developing nations aren't really developing very much, but
right.
China sure is. And there, I think it's in your book, remind me if I'm giving the information correctly, is importing as much oil as the United States.
Well, no, that's not correct, actually. China did, however, last year surpass Japan to become the world's second foremost oil importing nation after the U.S., China isn't slated to get up to the level of U.S. imports until probably 2020, 2025, if we get there. But that's really all hypothetical, really, because there just isn't going to be the volume of oil exports available to support that level of imports by that time. But, China's rate of oil import increased something like 40%. Year over year, the last 2 years. And
we wanted them to keep, indirectly, we want them to keep importing oil because we want to keep selling them cars. And if they're going to have cars, they've got to have gasoline.
Well, sure. And we all have these nice comforting images in our minds of the Chinese riding millions of bicycles over their city streets. But last year, Shanghai actually banned bicycles on the streets because they were getting in the way of the cars.
Yeah, yeah.
So not only is India increasing its oil imports, or not only is China increasing its oil imports, but India is as well. And we're talking there about a total of 2 billion people. So even a relatively small per capita increase in energy consumption in those two nations translates to really huge increases in global oil demand. that's part of what we're seeing now, increased demand and slackening off of available spare production capacity.
Well, that has. In fact, that's you took that up in your book, The Party's Over, and it's continued here in Power Down. On the back of Power Down, it says, where will you be when the oil runs out? What are the possible scenarios for avoiding madness and mayhem? I can hear the charges. Richard Heinberg, you're this is all Chicken Little scenarios. this is, that the sky isn't falling, and there's lots of ways in which we could deal with this, finding new fields. One of the scenarios you talk about is waiting for a magic elixir, wishful thinking, false hopes. Well, let's see, wishful thinking, that we're all going to get onto these hybrid cars, we're going to have hydrogen-powered cars, and there'll be a smooth transition brought to you by the people that are currently part of the problem that you see.
Yeah, I've tried to analyze all of those fixes, and, I'm a naturally optimistic person. I would dearly love to see the human race survive and advance and the next generation be able to take over from us and enjoy, live long and prosper. But, if you look carefully at any of these alternatives that's being proposed, there are serious problems. With alternative hydrocarbons, for example, like the tar sands of Alberta, there's lots of hydrocarbon molecules there and under the soil of Alberta, but the rate of production is constrained by the nature of the resource. Yeah, there's lots there, but we can't extract it at any arbitrary rate, and Alberta will be lucky to get up to, say, 2 million barrels a day.
Well, what about if we had all our cars were getting 60 miles a gallon because they were all hybrids?
So. Right. Well, certainly we will need to go in that direction, and I believe that trend will accelerate as oil becomes much more expensive. That's a short-term fix because oil isn't going to just go up to $5 a gallon and just stay there forever. As the existing supplies deplete, we will need to revamp our entire transportation infrastructure. We will have to rely less on personal automobile ownership and travel. And I really don't see any way around that. The idea of hydrogen cars, for example, is not very realistic because you have to use energy to get hydrogen. You have to either make hydrogen from natural gas, which most commercial hydrogen is made from now, or you have to use electricity to make it from water with electrolysis. And, of course, that means we would need a heck of a lot more electricity. Hmm. And where is that going to come from?
Well, people like Rush Limbaugh would say, you, Richard Heinberg, you're just part of these environmental wackos that are trying to take away our SUVs. Those are the cars that Americans want to drive. That's the kind of lifestyle that we want to have, and you're using this Chicken Little scenario in order to bring people around through almost blackmail to your point of view. Hey, maybe I could get a job doing that. That's...
Well,
I got to have a little more anger in my voice.
Point of view aside, yes, I'm an environmental wacko. I would like to see all of us using much less energy and relying on renewable alternatives. Fine, but when you hear someone like Matt Simmons say the same thing,
now who's that?
He was a member of the Cheney Energy Task Force.
Oh, okay.
He's a lifelong Republican energy investment banker. He has the largest energy investment bank in the world, Simmons Incorporated. And Matt Simmons has been sounding the alarm on global oil peak for years now. In fact, if you want to read some real pessimism, forget about The Party is Over. Go and read Matt Simmons' website and you'll get a real dose.
Hmm.
So, this is not really about politics. This is just about the limits of the natural world, which we have tried desperately to ignore for as long as possible, and they're catching up with us. And we have a range of choices about how to deal with those limits, but most of them are not very attractive.
Well, the one that you start with is the last one standing. That's the path
right.
We're on now, the path
exactly.
Of... by forcefully commanding the world's oil resources. And right now, it's a pretty volatile situation. the United States and Iraq is essentially losing, if you understand that there's whole areas of Iraq that are under the control of the insurgents. Saudi Arabia, always a dicey situation. Venezuela, that we've managed to, that Bush has been able to terminally alienate. So the last one standing means the most powerful dog gets the bone. That's the United States.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot of historical precedent for this strategy. Resource wars are nothing new. They go back to the beginning of time. Even World War II was in many ways an oil war.
Sure.
And so...
Japan. That's when, in fact, that's pretty much what precipitated World War II, right?
Exactly. When when the U.S. cut off oil exports to Japan, of course, Hitler was looking for oil in Russia, which is why they invaded the Soviet Union and also in Northern Africa. So it, you know, that's kind of the default setting for industrial society at this point. As resources dwindle, we will start to fight over them. But you know, with modern weaponry, and particularly with nuclear weapons, if you imagine that scenario going forward, it gets really ugly really fast. And so if we don't want to go down that tunnel, I think we have to start exploring the alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to concentrate so much on the negative. I'm sure there are people probably thinking, well, as long as we're the big dog, what do we have to worry about? But there's a lot of big dogs, that are a lot of pups that are soon going to grow into big dogs, like China, like the possibility of Russia, who still is formidable, even though in pretty much in chaos now. But when people start getting their basics threatened, it's funny the tenacity that they have. So this last one standing, wars to control oil resources, seems to me to be extraordinarily fraught with danger, as you're indicating.
And then if you look at the ultimate outcome, I mean, oil is going to run out anyway, no matter who's in charge of it. So if we're not making plans now to live in a petroleum-free world and we're just relying on our military to gain access to what's left, well, okay, even if we succeed, what's our plan B in that case?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some more of the scenarios that you present, Richard Heidenberg, in your new book, Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. It's published by New Society Publishers. Lots of good books there, by the way. It's newsociety.com. You're listening to the Peter Werbe Show. And, well, it's, I mean, pretty much the option is contained in the title of your new book, Power Down. So, in other words, we stop using less energy. Isn't that going to erode what we call our lifestyle?
Well, it will change the way we live. And I think we have to understand that the way we live is going to change, whether we make a deliberate effort or not. I think we will enjoy the process much more if we are systematic about it, if we cooperate, and if we make that deliberate effort. And that's what I outline. Now, a number of people suggest that a kind of power-down scenario would be relatively painless. You know, once fossil fuels get more expensive, people will just naturally start buying hybrid cars and putting solar panels on their roofs and so on. Well, I can understand the motivation. By making it sound painless, it makes it sound more attractive. But what I do in the book is take a good, hard look at the power-down scenario, and I come to the conclusion that this is not going to be easy. It's going to require a tremendous amount of effort, a huge amount of investment, for example, in alternative energy infrastructure. We're not talking about $1 billion here or there, but literally tens or even hundreds of billions of dollars a year of new investment sustained over time, trillions of dollars altogether.
Well, there's no money for that currently.
Currently, there's no money for that.
Yeah.
And so we will have to take investment capital out of other sectors of the economy. Personally, I would suggest the defense budget would be a good place to start.
Well, let's say this. I would never want to take a penny from the defense budget, but I would be willing to take tens of billions from the war budget.
Yeah, right.
Okay? I mean, you'll go for that. Yeah, okay.
I hear you.
Yeah. That's where the rat hole is of our tax dollars going down the drain. Again, I'm always anticipating what would be objections to what you're saying,
and
there's probably the sense of the problem, first off, we and I, that's because I accept this, we have to convince people that this is a crisis that that a society like ours has never faced.
That's correct.
And that admit that it's there, then take such extreme measures to assure that we are not going to have a mass die-off of humans or ecological catastrophe or
resource wars
of immense destructive nature. So and it's, I think it's easy for someone to say when they hear an author on the air and then see no reflection of that in the political world.
Right.
It's just almost to pull their head inside of their collar and say they hope somebody deals with it, because
we live in an interesting kind of intellectual climate. It's a marketplace of ideas, it's sometimes called. You can hear somebody saying virtually anything, and if you want to hear a certain message, you can certainly find somebody out there who will be putting it forward. They say that for every expert, there's an equal and opposite expert someplace else. So, if people want to, pull in their heads or bury their heads in the sand, they can find nice, pleasant voices out there to give them that information. You know, what I'm trying to do is basically just tell it as I see it. And I've been looking at the global indicators on resource depletion, population pressure, habitat destruction for many years now. And as far as I can tell, even most of the pessimists and doomsayers are actually understating the nature of the problem. And unless we're willing to, pull off the blinkers and take a good hard look at where we're actually headed, I think we will just continue going in the same direction. And that's why I included the last chapter of the book, or the last one of the scenarios, which is building lifeboats.
The path of community solidarity and preservation.
Right.
Extraordinarily important. And how do you feel about, in some ways, what amounts to gestures? Like I real carefully recycle in my community, and
right.
then I look the guy next door, and he's got six trash barrels filled to the top. So it's almost like a gesture. And I was thinking about hybrid cars. I have a big four-door sedan with a big six-cylinder engine, and I do that mainly for comfort and some sense of safety. It's not an SUV or anything like that, and the mileage isn't very good. I think it gets like 20 miles a gallon or something like that. Do you think it's important for us as individuals, and maybe if you do, and how you live any differently, if you do, I mean, I don't live much differently than my next door neighbor. How important is that? I mean, I usually think of what we ought to really talk about is massive social change, and sometimes we can even lull ourselves into complacency by saying, oh, I recycle, and I've got a little car that gets 35 miles to a gallon instead
right.
of 20.
Well, some gestures are more important than others. I think ones that will assist with our personal well-being and survival in the coming economic and energy downturn are more important, like learning how to grow your own food, learning who your neighbors are, and building up some kinds of trusting relationships with people in your community. I think all of that is very important. But as you're saying, the solution is not going to happen by individuals just adjusting their behavior a little bit. We have to look at community solutions. We have to look at major changes in national policy and also at the international level. Because if you omit any one of these levels of scale, then really there's no possibility of the fundamental change that needs to happen.
Yeah. Do you hear any reflection of this in the current political scene? I sure don't.
No, I don't.
Yeah. This is too tough a question. How do we make it happen? I'm stuck on that one. I'm glad you didn't ask me.
Well, what I'm trying to do is just alert as many people as I possibly can to the reality of global oil peak. And there are more and more voices out there doing essentially the same thing. Because if a very sizable percentage, say, of the American people understand that what we're up against is simple geological limits, then when the prices do start to spike upward, there will be less of a possibility of our political leaders simply scapegoating other nations and inciting more resource wars as a supposed solution to the problem.
You know, this has an interesting facet to it, that if it actually being about our survival, it wouldn't matter whether you're a fundamentalist Christian right-wing Republican or a, you know, a liberal Democrat or whatever.
I mean, absolutely, yeah. I mean, my writings are because of my own background and beliefs and so on, are somewhat more geared to people on the left end of the political spectrum. But I think this message needs to get out to everyone, you know, regardless of their religious or political affiliations, because we're all in this together, you know. If it's left and right fighting it out, I don't think it's going to be any more attractive a situation than if, you know, it's the U.S. and Iraq fighting it out or whatever. You know, the only survivable scenario is going to be a cooperative one.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we actually never have talked, and we only have a minute or two remaining. About what, when we talk about alternative energy sources, and I think we did somewhat, Richard Heidenberg, yeah, when we discussed the parties over, about that we don't have to have nuclear, we haven't even talked about that monstrosity, but or even oil-fueled economies that as you said, it's running out, it causes wars. We didn't even talk about the hideous environmental damage that oil does. So is there enough there in wind and solar to give us a modern society?
Well, not the kind of society that we're accustomed to. Here's a little factoid. If we were to take all of the wind and solar production capacity that's been put in place over the last 20 years and double that, and then double it again, we still wouldn't be up to 1% of our national energy budget.
Huh.
So we're talking about the need for, as I was saying earlier, just immense levels of investment in order to make up for the depletion of not only oil but also natural gas. And that's not going to happen just as a result of market mechanisms, you know, price signals and all of that. It's going to take some deliberate reallocation of financial resources.
Well, don't say you weren't warned, people. You heard it here, Richard Heidenberg sounding the clarion alarm, and in readable terms and in ways that at least has a glimmer of hope towards the end. Stephanie Mills, who we've interviewed on this show before, she's the author of Epicurean Simplicity, says, here's a firm, humane, extraordinarily well-written assessment of the likely realities of life after fossil fuels soon to begin on the planet nearest you. The book is Power Down, Options and Actions. That's important for a post-carbon world. Richard Heidenberg has been my guest. Richard, as usual, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Yeah, thank you, Peter.
WRIF.com.
Time is running out. Time is running out on the best deal ever, on your opportunity to make an investment that can help you make more money, that will change your life forever. Time is running out on your chance to register for Oakland Community College's fall 2004 semester. Final walk-in registration for fall classes is on August 30th and September 1st. Register on the web or visit any of OCC's five convenient campuses to sign up for your choice of thousands of day, night, and weekend classes in literally hundreds of subjects like business, psychology, computer information systems, physics, English, pre-engineering, robotics, and more. If you want to take a giant step to a better life, Oakland Community College is your educational answer. Call or visit your local OCC campus now. They're in Auburn Hills, Waterford, Farmington Hills, Royal Oak, and Southfield. Remember, final walk-in registration is August 30th and September 1st. Oakland Community College. Get anywhere from here.
Fall classes begin September 2nd. Get your clubs ready and head out to Treetops Resort. Treetops, located in Gaylord, Michigan, is home to the number one par 3 course in the U.S. Treetops is proud to be rated the top golf course to play by Golf Magazine, as well as being recognized as being a silver medal award winner. Also ranked by USA Today as the top 10 places to take dad, this is certainly a place where you need to be. There are four unforgettable courses, three of them designed by top-notch golfers. So call now and make certain you're able to take in the
incredible sights of Treetops Resort. Call 1-888-TREETOPS. That's 1-888-TREETOPS. Be sure to ask for the WRIF Stay and Play offer for just $99 during the month of August. That's 1-888-TREETOPS for this special price. Oh, and when you call, make sure you ask for the great prices on ski packages available for this winter. Offer subject to availability. Some restrictions apply. The $99 Stay and Play offer won't last forever, so call now. 1-888-TREETOPS.
This is WRIF.com.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
What the hell does Detroit want with Arkansas?
Well, you know, just same old thing. Just shoot the breeze, you know.
Damn, I ain't got time to mess you damn people up there. I got work to do here, and you keep calling, 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 raising hell with me. What's the matter? Every week or...
Well, you become an important part of the program, Delbert. It's actually, it should be a compliment.
Yeah.
What the hell does Michigan want with Arkansas?
I guess this is the first time we've run into you in a bad mood.
Well, you know, I guess everybody gets that once in a while after so much irritation.
Yeah.
Did something happen the last time we talked?
No, I don't reckon. This is the way it has to be, I guess. Let me tell you one thing before you hang up.
All right.
All right.
This is an April Fool's joke on you bastards.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, in an election season in which we're told the economy is key, how did what amounts to the biggest pay cut in history fly under mainstream media's radar? The Bush administration changes in overtime rules, which will mean less take-home for millions of U.S. workers, have been on big businesses' wish list for years, and they've already been debated in both houses of Congress. Yet media's reaction could perhaps best be summed up, huh? David Swanson of the International Labor Communications Association will fill us in on the important story big media bungled. Also on the show, journalist Jason Leopold says the story of Dick Cheney's tenure as Halliburton chief, featuring creative Enron-esque accounting, is the stuff that Pulitzer Prize stories are made of. But, he says, no mainstream journalist has the nerve to dig into it. Leopold will join us to talk about Dick Cheney's corporate scandal. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
Hundreds of thousands of protesters have been in New York City this week, taking part in a range of actions protesting the Republican National Convention and the Bush administration. After all their fear-mongering, most media had to acknowledge that the protests were overwhelmingly peaceful, and some of the coverage was fairly straightforward. Still, although most reports were not as silly as Fox News, where Rita Cosby asked New York Governor George Pataki with a straight face whether he was more concerned about protesters or Al-Qaeda, many outlets did trot out the old dismissive line on activists and activism. CBS's Bob Schieffer was one of those who didn't allow professed ignorance of protesters' concerns to interfere with his disdain. His take on the August 29th Face the Nation, quote, "The threat of terrorist attacks hangs over everything, and 250,000 demonstrators who have come to protest, who knows what, want to tramp all over the new grass in Central Park," close quote. In elite media, activists are considered gatecrashers and are faulted for representing a range of views, and even worse, wanting to be heard. As Howard Kurtz put it on CNN's Reliable Sources on August 29th, quote, "There are a lot of protesters who have descended on this city, and they are all from different kinds of groups and causes, and I'm not sure what some of them are protesting about, but aren't they here to get media attention? And how much do we cooperate in that?" Close quote. It's true, protesters did hope to gain media and public attention for their concerns, just like the people inside the convention hall. For all their complaining, big media never really explained why the latter deserved that attention and the former do not.
The New York Times had an explanation for the relative lack of coverage overall of the historic protests against the Republican convention. Tactics by police mute the protesters and their messages, so declared the headline of a September 2nd front page piece. The story reported that, quote, the New York Police Department has developed what amounts to a preemptive strike policy, cutting off demonstrations before they grow large enough, loud enough, or unruly enough to affect the convention, close quote. That's why, quote, for all the anger of the demonstrations, they have barely interrupted the convention narrative and have drawn relatively little national news coverage, close quote. But wait a minute. The protests on August 29th drew what were plausibly estimated as 500,000 demonstrators, and the police made little attempt to interfere with that legal march. So how large exactly would a protest have to be before it would affect the convention or draw serious amounts of national news coverage? Perhaps sensing that they hadn't really gotten to the point, the story went on to add that the demonstrations had been, quote, more restrained than many recent protests elsewhere, close quote. After making the absurd claim that the 1999 protests in Seattle involved widespread arson, the article states, quote, lacking bloody scenes of billy club-wielding police or billowing clouds of tear gas, the cameras and the public's attention have focused elsewhere, close quote. It's safe to say that if the public's attention is focused elsewhere, it's because without the cameras, they have little way of knowing what's going on outside the convention. And the cameras are not there, this article ultimately suggests, because demonstrations without violence are not considered real news by media decision makers. If you want to get coverage, smash things up. Is that really the message journalists want to send to protesters?
It seems clear that devoting serious coverage to activists would take elite media outside their comfort zone. They are, on the other hand, completely comfortable cozying up to powerful figures, even if these are the very politicians they're supposed to be independently tracking. In one recent example, noted in the August 31st Washington Post, John McCain held a birthday party at which a number of high-profile journalists hobnobbed with the prominent politician, who that day, or perhaps the next, would be the subject of their supposedly objective news stories. The guest list was too long to recite here, but it included Peter Jennings, Tom Brokaw, Dan Rather, Ted Koppel, Chris Matthews, Tim Russert, Charlie Rose, and Mort Zuckerman. Such private events are reminiscent of the kind of old boy companies where the real business is conducted on the golf course. Too bad for those that aren't on the invited list. Media coziness with the politically powerful isn't limited to the personal level, of course. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's trip to the Republican convention was actually paid for by a number of media companies, along with drug companies and oil firms, all of which have business before the California state government. Some of the companies bankrolling Schwarzenegger's travels were NBC Universal, News Corp, Time Warner, Disney, and Viacom, companies that will now turn around and report on the governor and their news divisions.
During a political convention, you might expect a certain amount of softer-than-usual coverage. But the cover story in Newsweek's September 6th issue, which arrived the week of the Republican National Convention, might be as soft as it gets. The cover image, a cocky John Wayne photo of George W. Bush, appears with the headline, No Excuses, The Virtues and Vices of Bush's Stubborn Resolve. The story inside is predictably high on virtues and low on vices, as it quotes many of Bush's friends, family, and close advisors. Newsweek's conclusion, quote, George W. hasn't just been independent, he's been defiant, close quote. The next page, though, is really the highlight, a two-page fold-out poster called The Incredible W, with a large cartoon-style image of Bush as a kind of mixture of Atlas and the Incredible Hulk. The accompanying text tells us what Bush would do in his second term, and under Bush's face, in bold type, it reads, quote, some days a guy can feel he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders. For George W. Bush, it's every day, close quote. Newsweek tells us that with Bush having so many enemies, Afghanistan, Iraq, and France, quote, you'd think those jogging, scarred knees might just start to buckle. But to the millions of Americans who cringe at the thought of John Kerry sitting behind the big desk, Bush is a heroic Hulk who's bravely kept the country safe from terrorists and tax hikes, close quote. Nothing would make this pandering really acceptable, but Newsweek's carrying water for Bush might be understandable anyway if the magazine had covered the Democratic nominee in a similar way. In other words, in terms of what those who cringe at the thought of his opponent winning think about him. But that didn't happen. The corollary, August 2nd issue, focused on John Kerry's character as a distant, aloof figure whose political positions, quote, seem to require endless, occasionally tiresome explanation, close quote. The Kerry piece included a sidebar by William Weld, the former Republican governor of Massachusetts who lost a run for Senate against Kerry. There was no such critical sidebar for the Bush piece, though there were two sidebars, one an interview with Bush himself, the other a profile of Laura Bush. Suffice it to say, Newsweek's coverage of Kerry did not include a fold-out poster portraying him as a superhero. The liberal media strike again.
Finally, Nightline deserves credit for its unsettling report on prison abuse and George Bush, aired on August 26th. Nightline's reporter Jake Tapper began the report thusly, quote, consider the following scenario. Some rather frightening prisoners, ones that might not meet with your sympathy, are placed in a situation where many are abused. Complaints are made to the proper authorities, but it is unclear if any of those ever reached Chief Executive George W. Bush. Those complaints largely go nowhere. Then months later, photographic evidence of the abuse emerges, whipping up a media outcry and a promise by Mr. Bush to get to the bottom of the atrocities, close quote. Tapper then described the abuse and humiliation methods used. Vicious dogs, men subjected to beatings and electric shock, made to stand nude and to crawl on their bellies. However, as Tapper eerily reveals, the story is not about Iraq or Abu Ghraib. It's about a prison in Texas when George W. Bush was governor there in the late 1990s. That's when Governor Bush's office failed to act upon complaints, until a videotape of the abuse made it to the media months later. Local news reports at the time faulted Bush for not acting sooner. The stories, unearthed by Nightline, show Bush on local news declaring the abuse appalling and promising justice, though only low-level guards were ever punished. In a healthy journalism environment, this relevant story would have been picked up and expanded upon by other media outlets. Unfortunately, no outlet that we could find has even mentioned this excellent Nightline report. Must have been too busy pursuing the most recent Swift Boat veteran recollections.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. It's often noted that corporate media tend to serve workers poorly, reporting economic and other news more often from the perspective of owners and investors. But every now and again, a story makes resoundingly clear that ascertaining and describing the impact of events or policies on people as workers is far down most mainstream media's list of priorities. Such a story is the recent set of changes in rules governing overtime pay, the biggest changes in overtime rules since the creation of the 40-hour week in 1938. Our next guest says it was fairly easy to figure out how the changes would affect most people, unless, that is, you tried to figure it out by reading the mainstream press. David Swanson is the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association and the author of a recent column, Media Misstory of Biggest Pay Cut in U.S. History. That was part of the ILCA's Media Blackout series on underreported labor stories. David Swanson joins us now in studio. Welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Well, for those who may have missed the story entirely, because it was kind of a 2-3 day story in some ways for the big media, give us just a quick understanding. These rule changes were basically changes in the way employers can determine who's eligible to get overtime. Is that right?
Exactly. Or who is exempt from the right to time and a half pay for working over 40 hours. And traditionally, the exemptions have included people who are supervisory, who are managers, who are professional executives and are making salaries, not hourly pay. These changes will greatly weaken those protections to the point that for example, someone who is an assistant manager in a fast food restaurant and spends most of their time flipping hamburgers, but spends a little bit of their time supervising in some way two other employees, will not be able to claim the right to overtime pay. So there are at least 6 million Americans who have lost the right to overtime as of August 23rd.
And when you get that 6 million figure, that's because there has been some research done on this. There is some background here. Who's looked into it to get those kinds of figures of the impact?
Well, the changes are there for anyone to read in the law from the Labor Department. It's 500 pages. It's not an easy thing, but given the resources expended on celebrity scandals, our media might be able to handle it. But you also have some assistance out there. You can turn to the Economic Policy Institute, which published a very clear analysis over a month ago. There are a number of former officials of the Departments of Labor under Reagan, Bush, and Clinton who have published very similar conclusions to what EPI put out, and other testimony in congressional hearings from various experts all point to the same general findings.
Well, all right, then. If someone wanted to learn about these changes and they went not to those sources but to the mainstream press and the television networks, what basically would they have found?
They wouldn't have found much at all to inform them of anything. If they turned to the article that was put out by the Associated Press that showed up in many newspapers, the lead sentence of the article was as follows: paychecks could surge or shrink for a few or for millions of workers across the country starting Monday when sweeping changes to the nation's overtime pay rules take effect.
Okay.
So who knows anything more than they did before they read that sentence? And the rest of the article was along the same lines. And all of the articles that I found in mainstream newspapers were sort of like articles you would find in the sports section. Here's what the Labor Department says, here's what these other groups claim, without any sort of analysis or research by the reporter to the effect that these claims are backed up and these are blatant lies.
And not just that, but there was a kind of overt, I mean, they were actually saying nobody understands this.
Right. A huge percentage of the headlines of these articles were not just this side says A, this side says B, but new changes to overtime rules confusing, impossible to determine, labor and employees and companies mystified, confused. So they're reporting on a debate or a controversy, not on what this means to workers. And the debate is of their own making. The facts are readily obtainable, not just from independent economists, but also from independent media, from independent alternative websites, magazines, radio shows, and from the labor media.
Well, you point out that it wasn't that mainstream media was totally devoid of articles that made the points more clear. It was just that they didn't tend to be reporting. They were sort of found in other places in the media.
Yeah, there were a lot of good columns. There were dozens, in fact, of good columns. And in one case, there was a very fine editorial in the New York Times whose editors said that the analyses of these changes put out by the labor and independent economic groups were persuasive and solid. But the New York Times published a report, an article in their news section that did not arrive at that conclusion in any form. It said the Labor Department claims more workers will get overtime pay. The labor movement claims fewer workers will get overtime pay. Nobody knows.
Nobody really knows. Well, you'd also get the impression from the media that it was kind of out of the blue. I saw one headline that was employers scramble to understand new overtime rules. That was the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. But you touched on this before. This really should not have been a surprise. Congress has debated this. There's a record here, right?
This was in the works for a year and a half, in some ways much longer. And the original proposal was much worse, and there was such outrage that it was modified, although not sufficiently. And some of the elements that really outraged people in the original from the Labor Department included advice to employers on how to get around having to pay overtime pay. So even for a reporter who didn't have the resources to really study what's true and what's false here ought to have known where the Department of Labor was coming from. The idea that their motivation was simply to clarify or to benefit workers, the idea that the Bush administration is a reliable source of information and is out to benefit workers, was just a phenomenal leap for the media to take.
Well, you touched on this also, but it really kind of reinforced for you and probably for others the importance of alternative media, including the labor media.
Absolutely. Any number of stories over the past several months, including changes to the right to organize a union, including the U.S. labor movement's newfound opposition to the war in Iraq, these are stories that have not been touched and not been communicated in any clear way to readers of mainstream newspapers or viewers of the television networks and cable news networks. But if you turn to the labor media, if you turn to the alternative media, you can find very clear reporting and a variety of points of view. And in fact, on this overtime change, if you turn to television, you saw a huge rally outside the Department of Labor on the day these changes took effect, and then you immediately had commentary to the effect of, there's the controversy, here are the facts. And then the Department of Labor's point of view was presented. So even a well-organized, well-attended rally with clear speeches, with dozens of network TV cameras out front, became an opportunity to communicate the Bush administration's point of view.
We've been speaking with David Swanson, media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association. You can find them and David Swanson's media blackout series on underreported labor stories on the ILCA's website, which is ilcaonline.org. Thank you, David Swanson.
Thanks.
Another little-noticed story in this summer of Republicans and swift boat stalking horses comes to us from journalist Jason Leopold. In a recent piece for Alternet, Leopold writes that there are reams of evidence about Halliburton in the 1990s when Dick Cheney headed the company that show that its accounting methods differed little from those used by the likes of Enron. But, writes Leopold, it's obvious that no mainstream news reporter has the gumption to seriously question Vice President Dick Cheney's ethics. Leopold is the former Los Angeles bureau chief of Dow Jones Newswires, where he spent 2 years covering the energy crisis and the Enron bankruptcy. His latest article on Cheney is titled, How Dick Cheney Got Away with $35 Million Right Before the Government Launched a Probe into Halliburton. Jason Leopold joins us now by phone from Los Angeles. Jason Leopold, welcome to Counterspin.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Jason, we'll get to journalists and their gumption or lack of it in a moment. But first, you say there are reams of evidence showing that Dick Cheney misbehaved while he was chief of Halliburton.
Yeah.
What is that evidence, and what does that evidence say in your view?
Well, it's pretty amazing because there are many SEC filings out there in the public domain, as well as stories when Dick Cheney was CEO of Halliburton. He spent 5 years as the chief executive of the company. And during that time, there were many accounting issues that came up in which it appeared later on that the way that Halliburton accounted for revenue was not on the up and up. For example, Halliburton used a method called mark-to-market accounting to let its shareholders and investors know that it was actually doing much better in the world of business than it actually was. All of Halliburton's profits, more or less, since when Cheney ran the company, have been erased because of accounting issues that violated SEC regulations.
Because they had to go back to more proper ways of accounting?
Well, they did not let investors know when there was a change in the accounting methods that they used. These profits were illusory, just like Enron. Just look at the record when Cheney ran the company. You'll see that there's not that much good that Cheney did. First of all, when he acquired Dresser Industries, which was another part of oil field services, Halliburton was saddled with asbestos liabilities. There is an issue right now that Cheney and Halliburton are being investigated for bribery in Nigeria. Then we have all the issues in which Halliburton was dealing with Iran and Libya and Iraq. So everything that Cheney is saying right now on the campaign trail in regards to corporate responsibility and in which he is also trying to let people know how much of this country is being threatened by these so-called terrorist regimes, which I don't doubt that that's a fact. It really contradicts what he did as a businessman and what he said while he ran Halliburton.
Jason Leopold, you say that Halliburton used accounting methods much like Enron used. But how can you be sure that Cheney was aware they were doing that at the time? Many of the executives at Enron are now claiming ignorance of the accounting methods that were happening under them.
Well, that's a very good question, and here's the short answer. Cheney had to sign off on all the SEC filings. The CEOs are required to sign off and everything, and in fact, if people were to simply just go back and look, they'll see that Cheney's signature is there. Arthur Anderson, who was also Enron's auditor and accountant, was Halliburton's. And Cheney is on video praising Arthur Anderson for going above and beyond the routine audits that the company does. It's strange in a way that this has sort of been underreported, but he is out there praising them for their work, in which they were able to show investors, on paper at least, that we're doing very well. In fact, what was going on behind the scenes in Halliburton was that they weren't doing well. But to go even a step further, Halliburton's current CEO, Dave Lesser, told Newsweek in 2002 that not only was Cheney aware of the accounting measures that were employed, Cheney also, quote, helped us collect money.
Jason Leopold, in your alternate piece, you say that the Cheney story is the stuff that Pulitzer Prizes are made of, but that no mainstream journalist has the nerve to go there. Tell us why you say that.
There's a combination of factors that contribute to this. First of all, this is the stuff Pulitzers are made of. If one journalist were to simply investigate this, really look into what went on when Cheney ran the company, because, first of all, during those 5 years, there has been a great deal of information that has come out. There are SEC investigations, Justice Department investigations. There's even an investigation by France into this whole bribery allegation. This all happened when Cheney was at the company. These large mainstream newspapers, they have the resources to send some reporters out there to maybe speak to some former employees or even current employees to really see what he knew and what he didn't. That's the funny thing about this administration and about Cheney's tenure at Halliburton. We have yet to see exactly what Cheney knew, what Cheney did when he ran this company. There has been not one single story that has been investigative in nature that really, really got to the heart of what went on while Cheney ran the company. And I believe that there's a, first of all, it does take time. It takes a lot of time. It's tedious work. You have to sit there and read SEC filings. It's boring. However, the outcome of it would actually be a huge story. It would be something that would give people the opportunity to think, to make choices, to get some critical analysis. But right now, we're seeing an industry and the journalism community that does not want to come off as quote-unquote liberal, that if they were to do something like that, they would be tarred and feathered. They may be smeared. We have journalists that unfortunately put fear in front of truth, and they don't want to rock the boat.
We've been speaking with journalist Jason Leopold. His piece, How Dick Cheney Got Away with $35 Million Right Before the Government Launched a Probe into Halliburton, can be found at alternet.org. His new book, Off the Record, an investigative journalist's inside view of dirty politics, high finance, and corporate scandal, is due out in March. Jason Leopold, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to the Riffs Night Call. Night Call is a public affairs presentation of 101 WRIF Detroit. The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the management or sponsors of WRIF Radio or Greater Media Detroit. Night Call is hosted every Sunday night by Peter Werby. Now stay tuned for more Riff Rock, coming right up on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Hi, I'm David Hall from Rock Financial with some breaking news. Mortgage interest rates still close to all-time lows, but Greenspan says they won't be this way forever. Take advantage of Rock Financial's exclusive Smart Arm today. Fix in your interest rate 3 years under 4%. That's right, fixed in for 3 years under 4%. Call the mortgage experts right now at 800-333-ROCK and find out how to increase your monthly cash flow, pay on principal when you want to with the Smart Arm. Only the mortgage experts can handle any loan amount, any situation, whether refinancing, purchasing, consolidating debt, taking cash out, even doing some home improvements. You'll be amazed at the little difference a little expert advice can make. Call the mortgage experts today at ROCK Financial, 800-333-ROCK. 3 years, less than 4%. Lock in before Greenspan locks you out. 800-333-ROCK.
ROCK Financial is a Quicken Loans company, an equal housing lender. Details at rockfinancial.com.
The party is here at Leopard's Lounge and Royal, Windsor's number one gentleman's club. Every week, Leopard's Lounge brings you new girls from all over the world, so it never gets boring. And these girls are hot. And unlike other gentlemen's clubs, which we won't mention, Leopard's Lounge never has a cover charge, ever. They even have free parking. It's an offer you can't refuse. Join 101 The Riff and the beautiful Leopard's Lounge girls. Listen every Tuesday night for your chance to win tons of free Riff gear, tickets to cool stuff, and, well, let's just say special attention from the smoking hot Leopard's Lounge ladies. Guys, you know you work hard, so you deserve a night out. Why not make it a Riff night? Tuesday night at Leopard's Lounge. Sit back and enjoy the finer things in life. You know what I'm talking about. Beer, sexy, beautiful women, and tons of free stuff. Hey, they even break out the free pizza at 11 o'clock. It just doesn't get any better than this. Don't miss the fun this Tuesday night with 101 WRIF at Leopard's Lounge in Windsor. Just 5 minutes from the bridge or tunnel at 1190 Wyandotte West. Call 1-888-653-8881 for Leopard's Lounge and Broil.
Why are men all over America talking about Testosterpro? Listen.
After I tried Testosterpro, I felt like I was the man I wanted to be. I wish I'd found out about it sooner because I feel like I'm more of a man now than when I was younger.
I'm Dr. Richard Cohen, MD, men's health specialist. In many men, testosterone levels can fall rapidly after age 35. But now there's Testosterpro, the complete performance boosting system I designed for men who are starting to feel their age. If you don't feel like the man you used to be, call now for a 30-day risk-free trial of the Testosterpro system, which includes my bonus report on aging and its effects on energy, sex drive, and stamina, free with your order.
Call now for your confidential trial of Testosterpro. 1-800-897-3124. 1-800-897-3124. Results will vary. 1-800-897-3124. Guaranteed or your money back. 1-800-897-3124.
The station that gets you back to the Riff Rock quicker.
Well, there you have it.
This is it. Don't get scared now.
Riff Rocks.
Hey, Detroit, this is Ryan.
And this is Chad. We're from Nickelback, and you're listening to Detroit's home of rock and roll, 101 WRIF, The Riff.
Lou, you're my boy!